Okay, today is August 29th, 2014. This is the first interview with Peter Rickman. We're going to talk to him about his time in graduate school and specifically about his involvement in the 2011 protests at the Capitol. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Peter, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure, it's Peter Rickman, R-I-C-K-M-A-N.
Okay. I'm going to take just a quick peek here and see where we're at volume-wise. I can turn it up a little bit. Okay. So we should be fine.
Great.
So, Peter, as I mentioned before we turn this on, the first question is, why come to UW-Madison?
For graduate and law school. So I grew up in Wisconsin, in northeast Wisconsin, in the city of Neenah. And I did what I call my years abroad. I went to undergraduate in Miami University in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I think if there was one thing I could change about something that I've made a major life decision on, it's probably that I would have gone to UW-Madison for undergraduate education. It's such a fantastic institution. I after undergrad and working. Doing organizing work and social movement organizing work, decided that I wanted to go to graduate school and law school to be able to build some of the technical skills that, you know, it seemed to me were desperately necessary in a dying labor movement that needed to figure out new ways to organize and build power for working people. So after making the decision and convincing my my lady friend and fiance that it was okay for me to go to grad and law school, made a decision to go to UW-Madison for a couple reasons. One, it would be the least expensive. Two, it would have the highest possibility for funding, most likely. And there would be a chance while going to school and working here to be part of a venerable graduate student workers union in the Teaching Assistants Association. And that was actually a really important thing to me as someone who'd be working, but as also someone who has, for his adult life, made activism in social movements, and particularly in the union movement, the labor movement, a really central core part of who I am.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, did I hear you right? Did you do some work in undergraduate in terms of social movements and social activism?
I did not mention that, but it was pretty minimal when I went to undergrad. I paid my way through college and worked a number of different jobs at different times, and so I was not particularly involved on my own campus. Supported a certain number of different things, but was never heavily involved, and certainly not in any sort of leadership role on campus. I worked university food service, like not one of the student learner jobs, but like one of the jobs they hire people from the rest of the world to do. Yeah. And I worked in a dining hall for a while and had a pretty, there was a pretty important experience that I had at that point in time. At the school where I was, Miami University, there was very nearly right after the time that I ended up quitting the job because I had made enough money to get through the semester and I wanted to just focus on the school stuff. there started to be a pretty significant amount of unrest amongst the food service workers and clerical workers on campus because they were going through contract negotiations. And ultimately it led to a strike of the campus workers. And I happened to be in a human resource management class at the time where I had a professor who had worked for the National Labor Relations Board and took a lot of pride in being a third party neutral on labor relations issues. And he encouraged us and provided not extra credit, but credit for work in the class to go and you know, immerse ourselves in one part of the strike or another, and, you know, observe, you know, picket lines and talk to people there, go to fora being held on campus about this. And that in of itself, I mean, that wasn't my introduction to the union movement, but it was a really formative thing because these are people I just worked side by side with. And but for the accident of having made, you know, enough money already to get myself through the semester, I would have been right there with them, and it would have been, you know, a fairly radicalizing experience, I think. But, you know, when I was on campus, you know, it was working and going to school as an undergraduate, and, you know, it was more things like that where I was supporting people who were doing what they were doing because, you know, made a choice about how to use my time. And maybe some of that led me to make a personal choice later on that, you know, it was important to be on the front lines in the in the struggle.
Mm-hmm. Peter, can we back up again and talk mm-hmm. a little bit about your growing up in Neenah?
Yeah.
What did your parents
do? My dad bargained for management on the opposite side of the table from my mom's union. My dad had spent a few, by the time he retired a couple years ago, he had spent a few decades working in the technical college system here in Wisconsin, and originally started as a teacher and was on the union bargaining committee, and it turned out he was so good at it, the management wanted to hire him to be on their side. And he spent his career doing, you know, labor relations and human resources work for the technical college system, Fox Valley Technical College, which also happened to be a place where my mom worked, secretary and helping teach administrative assistant classes. And, you know, my dad had joked all the time about that pink Okami rag, the NEA newsletter. And for anyone who knows much about unions, they're far from it. So it was, you know, sort of tongue in cheek and, you know, poking my mom. You know, I heard about unions and collective bargaining at the dinner table growing up. And to me, it was just sort of a normal thing. You know, when my dad was preparing for negotiations, he'd have all his stuff laid out across the table. And it was, you know, a really intense thing for him. But it was like, that, you know, that's what you do. And, you know, he was never bad rapping the union. And, you know, I learned from him that, like, collective bargaining was where he felt like they solved problems as opposed to the source of problems. And, you know, it stuck with me. And you know, I like to say that I knew early on, growing up, having heard the proverbial both sides, I knew which side I was on. And, you know, some of that came from also growing up in the in the Catholic Church and having some exposure to Catholic social teaching. Which is pretty clear and unequivocal, even more so than many of the world religions, is as far as prioritizing workers and respecting the dignity of the individual worker and having that manifest itself and the importance of collective action, collective rights, and the role of unions and in a democratic society. And so that sort of general experience growing up, along with, you know, having read some books and then working for a living, you know, working in a plastic plant, working in food service, as a janitor, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. sort of forms your political view of the world as far as, you know, which side you're on.
Mm-hmm. So, graduate school and law school, what school or department did you want to get your graduate degree in?
I was a dual degree student in the law school and the La Follette School of Public Affairs, and I dropped out before I finished either of them.
Okay.
Which relates to all the stuff we're talking about here. There's a
right.
very clear connection.
Right. So, what fall did you matriculate here? What year?
It would have been 2008.
And did you immediately become interested in being involved in the TAA at that point?
Signed a card before I even came to campus. Yeah, absolutely. And I should say, I also took a couple of part-time classes the spring and the fall previous to that, just to make sure that being back in school was something I felt like I could mentally handle.
So how long have you been, how long was the gap between undergraduate and going back to graduate school then?
4 or 5 years, something like that.
And were you at Is Miami of Ohio in a town called Miami?
It's in Oxford, Ohio. Oh,
okay. So were you in Oxford for that time, or were you?
No. Spent another year living in Chicago, and then I was living in Madison here before that.
Oh, okay.
By the way, we like to say that Miami was a university when Florida still belonged to Spain. We just want to make sure that that's really clear.
I like that.
Please duly note that in the oral history.
Yeah, it is. It is duly noted. So, how was the? You said you took classes, basically a class or two a year before to transition into a certain extent. But how was it getting here? And you were here, but being a full time student on campus that first semester.
It was great. I mean, I loved. I loved. The life of the mind, and studying, and it wasn't every class wasn't everything that I wanted, but it sure was pretty cool to spend my time studying and thinking about the world as it had been and was, and what it could be, and that was my whole point in coming to graduate school and law school, again, to appropriate some of the skills and a view and a perspective to contribute to what I felt needed to happen in a labor movement for the 21st century. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was, it's like boot camp. It's like training. It's preparation. And there's a certain degree of excitement when you're in that. Sure, it's intense, and there are times when you're like, why do I have to do this econ assignment or prepare for this exam? And it's stressful, and you want to do well on it. But, it was all for something that I was driving towards. It was great.
Right. So, again, just to briefly back up, when you moved to Madison, where did you, and I assume your lady friend, where did you and your lady friend live?
We first lived in an apartment in Fitchburg, just off of... Fish Hatch, down by PD, and then we moved from there to a house on Spruce Street, in the Bayview area.
How did you? You said you signed a card before coming, before coming back to school.
Yeah.
Do you recall when you first became actually involved in TAA stuff?
Oh, yeah, right away. I mean, the fall, the summer even before I was on campus, I just started getting involved in the work of the union. And I knew that that was something I was going to do. It was sort of like a ringer. Mm-hmm. And got involved in, the organizing work, the political work of the union. And joined the executive board, actually, prior to even starting school and classes. I was elected to be the chair of one of the committees.
That's sort of a meteoric rise.
In the glorious world of grad student worker union politics. The annals of history are now recording my exploits and feats.
But it sounds like you were able to balance the academic part of going to school and then the activism, the TAA part.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a...
my wife may have a slightly different view of things, but yeah, absolutely. And, for as long as I can remember, I have had a capacity and willingness to just work harder than anyone else that I know of, and be pretty intense about it, and that probably gets me in trouble sometimes. But I was willing to do whatever it took for as long as it took to, make sure that I was advancing the work of the union, of the movement, while still doing my school things and all that. And it helps too, in graduate school, and when I first came to campus. This is the nature of the dual degree program, is you do 1 year of grad school and 1 year of law school, or vice versa, and then you mix and match courses till you finish, and then you do your requirements and your writing and such. So I did a year of grad school first because, law school is just frankly, it's more intense than grad school. And I wanted to do my first you know, when I hit campus, it also happened to be at the time of a presidential election, and I wanted to be able to spend a lot of time working on that. And I knew that, you know, the first year of law school it'd be tougher to have that much more discretionary time, you know, for the work of the union. So anyway, that, you know, that might have helped a little bit too, mm-hmm. just being in grad school. And it certainly helps that, you know, when you're in grad school, there's it's not just going and doing required courses. It's like, you know, you actually like the things that you're studying. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
So what work did you do on the 2008 election?
Well, we built a pretty amazing political program inside the TAA that I'm, you know, really proud of to this day. Just engaging and mobilizing our members and then other members of the state federation of which we were part, AFT Wisconsin, to go out and do the grassroots work that it takes to win elections. And, you know, obviously in 2008, a lot of people were really thinking about and focused on electing Barack Obama to be the next president. but for the TAA, as a union of people employed by a university that is a creature of the state, it was really important to me that we make a significant impact on some state legislative races. This is at the time when the Democrats were about to take over the majority in the Assembly after having done so in the Senate in 2006. And obviously, there was a Democratic governor then. So this presented itself as potentially an opportunity to make major progress in Wisconsin by having Democrats in charge. There would at least be some room to maneuver instead of, you know, obstruction from the Republicans, or as we see right now, just, you know, an all-out assault that puts working people on the defensive. So we worked to, getting members activated, coming out to the office literally 7 days a week to phone bank or to canvas. We made an impact on a number of state legislative races and made sure that we got all the credit we deserve for it with leadership in the state legislative body, so that we would be able to translate that into some concrete gains. It's the nature of public sector unionism that it's intimately tied to the political arena, and we use that to the best of our ability to, you know, advance the material standards of the union and of the membership. And yeah, it wasn't really something that had been done tremendously in the TAA before, and hadn't had, like, there wasn't like a history of a really disciplined, systematic, rigorous political program, and that was something I take credit for helping to build there. And that was pretty great for people to then see, like, oh, you know, we built a great program that moved people, and now we can go and use some of the clout or influence from that to make further gains, which we did.
How did you know how to do that, or how did you know that that's what you wanted to do?
How did I know that that's what I had wanted to do? Those are two different questions, right. So maybe I should answer them separately.
Yeah, please do.
Do you want me to do that? Okay. Yep. how did I know how to do it? There's a few things in this world that I'm pretty good at, and have a savant-like ability to figure out very quickly any things that I don't know, and organization building and politics and moving workers is sort of all together. That's one. And I'd done organizing work prior to this, and knew how to put together a political program, and I knew the state political scene pretty well. I'd been an activist before that when I was living in Madison, and it was no great feat to be able to put together, you know, a really solid, strong political program. And, you know, part of it too is just being willing to work harder than anyone else is, you know, staying at the office till 10 at night or whatever, getting things done. And I could just wax boring for a while about some of the nuts and bolts, but I don't think that's particularly interesting. But how did I know that's what I wanted to do? I like to think that I'm a fairly thoughtful and contemplative person who considers the world as it is and where I think it ought to be and what I can do about it and come up with a way to make that happen. And, it seemed to me that it would be extremely important, no matter what, as essentially a state employee union for the TAA, that we have some political power, as we're going to be doing, you know, further contract negotiations and being able to, you know, advance and make progress on our other agenda. And one of the things that I really like about, you know, that union that I was a part of there is I think we took a pretty broad view of the role of the union representing its membership. And, you know, so part of that is representing student workers as workers and as students. And so, you know, we knew that an issue of segregated fees was something we'd likely have to deal with through a comprehensive effort, including in the political arena. And so, you know, it was pretty clear to me on a number of different fronts that we needed to build a political program. And, you know, this is a true statement wherever you are, whether you're talking about state employee unions or, you know, other public sector workers, working people generally, or, you know, even outside that realm. For most people, that which is political at least starts with elections and legislation, as opposed to the glorious contest for authoritative power in a democratic society in name. So there was an opportunity there because of the heightened importance and the possibility for you know, electoral change in 2008, that there would be a crop of people that we could engage amongst the TAA membership and amongst the AFT membership to get involved in the union, because there was some salience and some of the political work and some consciousness about what was happening, and a real zeitgeist, I think, for people, you know, becoming activists. So it was instrumental for some of the agenda gains on the agenda of the union, but also in terms of building the union itself for the longer term. It was a vehicle for that, and that's how I identified it, at least, to build for the future. And, you know, I think it played out for the most part.
You talked about seg fees. Were you here during the first campaign to try to renovate, I think it was the NAT and other other similar places, so the recreational facilities?
There was two Union South seg fee fights just before my time. Then the NAT one, I ran the campaign. I came up with a campaign to beat it. The No New Seg Fees campaign. If you'd like a t-shirt, I still have a bunch in my closet.
Oh, cool.
The green ones. Mm-hmm. They're kind of ugly, but they really served a purpose. Yeah, that was the largest student voter turnout in the history of the UW system to that point. But like two times over. Mm-hmm. And we won the referendum on that 2-1. That was part of a long-term campaign. Like I said before, a comprehensive effort to take on segregated fees is, you know, a backdoor tuition hike, a material degradation of the conditions of students, and just sort of very much a practical expression of the privatization, corporatization of the university, the advent of neoliberalism in the academy, the idea that, you know, there's market relationships involved in the access to education and what is part of the experience in an academic setting. So, you know, there was this larger fight about the, you know, the core values, the fundamental values, the priorities of the academic community, the university community, and again, of a democratic society. Access to affordable, quality public education is pretty much a given, at least it should be. But also a really practical fight that people come access. You can't run a campaign against neoliberalism and corporatization. You can run a campaign to beat back its practical expressions, like segregated fees. and the campaign that took that on, and I have a whole rap about this, and I'll probably end up taking you through a little bit of that through some of these questions, but the work that was done on that campaign very much directly followed from the activity in the organization built in some of the political work in 2008, mm-hmm. And then just, you know, general activism of the union and on campus and in the political arena, and then a conscious effort to build an alliance of left-oriented student groups. With the TAA providing a little bit of a center, in that the TAA had resources, physical financial personnel, that could, you know, buoy some of this. And then that in and of itself was part of a bridge towards building a broader student worker alliance that was taking on some of these bigger issues about the nature of the university and the public sector, which is also the clear and direct path to how there was this uprising. How's that for whetting your appetite for future discussion?
That is an appetite whetting, yes. So, to come back to the academic part, just so we have it down for sure. So, you're in graduate school, you're in the TAA. Mm. Do you actually have a teaching assistantship that first year?
I was doing the first year was a fellowship, and then after that, I ended up this is juicy. I ended up with a project assistantship through the School of Public Affairs, that was essentially a contract with AFSCME District Council 40, which is the County and Municipal Employees Union for 71 of the 72 counties, and I was working in the research department there essentially. It was like a PA ship through La Follette that was loaned out to a public sector union. And so I did research on collective bargaining and legislation and all kinds of things.
And so that would have been the second year then, the fall of 2010?
That sounds about right.
Or you came fall of 2008, so more like fall of 2009 maybe?
Oh, no, I was still on, essentially a grant fellowship for the first year of law school. So that would have been after that. It would have been the next year after that.
Okay. So then you did graduate school to follow up the first year.
The first year,
and then you did law school.
The first year of law
school. That would then be the second year.
Yep.
And then you got this PA.
And then I was in doing grad and law school courses together.
Okay. So then if this is the fall of 2010, this PA ship that you have researching, what sounds like just the type of things you want to research, is also coming around the time of the 2010 election.
Yeah. God, what a disaster that was.
What did the... So what was the difference in your mind between what you and the TAA were doing in 2008 and what was done in 2010?
We still tried to run a great... an effective program, and I think considering the circumstances, we did. But the circumstances were dramatically different. The grounded realities of 2010 differed so much from 2008 that it's almost incomparable. I mean, this is coming on the heels of, you know, for people of the left like me, you know, extreme frustration with what has been happening at the national political scene, which always filters down into state and local things. Tremendous disappointment for people of the left like me who care deeply about state and local politics and seeing what was happening in our capital in terms of having a Democratic majority in the Assembly and the Senate and a Democratic governor that were just totally unable or unwilling to deliver on major things. And coming on the heels of an economic crisis where it seemed like the elected Democratic leadership was just, again, totally unwilling or unable or so compromised that, you know, they would only take not even half measures to address this, you know, raging economic and social crisis going on, but then would paint a bunch of happy talk about, no, things are great, things are working. I mean, it was inevitable that this revanchist right-wing backlash was going to come, and it was accelerated by the ineptitude of you know, political elites, left of center political elites. And so you've got general failure in the governing arena, tremendous frustration amongst those who would or could be activists, and then amongst the strata of people who are marginally engaged in politics, just sort of, checking out in a lot of ways. So it was very difficult to build a powerful grassroots force, which is what we could do. I mean, we're the Teaching Assistance Association. It's not like we had a bunch of money to throw around. It's only people power. It was a very different situation. We struggled admirably. I should say this. I mean, one thing that was really important to us as grad student workers and to the union is that while the Democrats were in power, we were able to pass a landmark expansion of collective bargaining rights, ironically, for research assistants that both expanded collective bargaining rights for that 2,700 people who had been without rights and was going to be one of the major advances in academic worker unionism at the time, along with the, and not just in Wisconsin nationally, but that was also paired with an expansion of collective bargaining rights for faculty and academic staff, which was crucial for professional and academic white-collar worker unionism. And with the research assistant collective bargaining rights authorization, we also won the first majority sign-up and neutrality law in Wisconsin history. And so there was, you know, at least for people like me, where this sort of thing is really important and matters, you know, there was some satisfaction with what some of the Democratic legislative leadership had done, and a number of them had really delivered for us because of the political work that we had done in 2008. But that's not something you can go to your average, ordinary, everyday TA and be like, but the Democrats delivered on this major gain for the union that ultimately, in 5 years' time, is going to reap major material benefits for grad student workers, and you may not be here to see it, but, you know, the people of your kind will benefit from it. It's not easy to make that case to anyone, even if you can say, like, look, people before us fought and sacrificed tremendously so that they could win tuition remission in our contract. People before that fought tremendously and sacrificed greatly to be able to win the right for us to have a union. It's really hard to go out to people in a situation like 2010, but also just generally otherwise, and essentially sell them on an insider view of you know, the arc of movements and their place in that, and then move them to action. Because it doesn't feel like there's a real self-interest in getting involved in the struggle at that point in time. Especially if you're trying to finish up, write your thesis, prepare for prelims, whatever else it is. Mm-hmm. So there's always built-in challenges with grad student worker unionism, just like, you know, anywhere else. But, you know, 2010 was an extremely difficult period to do politics for people anywhere left of center. And you know, the other part of this is Tom Barrett was an extremely weak candidate, and being a resident of the city of which he is mayor, it's eminently apparent in the day-to-day practice. And, you know, I think this is a, you know, maybe a conversation for us to have over beers and not necessarily with a microphone, because it's maybe not all that interesting, or people who would listen to this have probably already come to their own conclusions about it. But, you know, it's a reflection of the you know, the fundamental weakness of the American left in terms of having an electoral strategy, and it's a comment on the fundamental flaws of the Democratic Party writ large, which is not a monolith, and I say that as someone who was at one point in time an elected member of the state party executive committee. You know, we got our ass kicked because Democrats didn't put forward any sort of real agenda for working people, and Scott Walker won the economic argument. Now, it's an economic argument that I disagree with vehemently, that if we put more money in the hands of corporations and the rich, that it will trickle down. We know that that doesn't work empirically, and it's also just morally objectionable. But it's not like there was an alternative put forward by Tom Barrett or anyone else, and really hasn't been amongst the Democrats at the elite level for decades. So all that came together to make 2010 just a total disaster, from the governor's race to the state legislative races and more, and that put us in an extremely difficult position. I remember sitting at a bar on the west side of Madison that night when election returns were coming in, and, you know, for those of us who had been really working on it, we already knew what the results were. We just didn't know how bad they were going to be, and the political director for AFSCME at the time was sitting at the table with me, and he looked at me and said, well, looks like everyone in Wisconsin is going to have to learn what right to work means in our state. And some of us, you know, activist and organizer types who were there, were already starting to talk about, well, what can we do to fight back against the inevitable attacks that are coming? And we didn't know what they were, but we knew they were going to be.
So, I mean, you just said this, but I want to make sure we clarify.
Yeah.
You being on the inside saw the writing on the wall. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but it sounds like you saw the writing on the wall that there was going to be a change, at least at the governorship level, at least at the gubernatorial level, even before, you know, the first Tuesday in November, you knew this was going to happen.
Yeah, it was just a matter of how badly we were going to lose, and if we were going to end up with, you know, 45 seats in the assembly or 35 seats, if we were going to end up with, you know, a near majority in the state Senate or enough of a deficit that the Republicans could just slam through an agenda over the objections of the so-called moderates. It was really just a matter of degrees. And that's what we're fighting for, those of us who believe in electoral politics.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you want to get to this yet, but I have what I think is a somewhat interesting story in terms of this, like, hindsight is 2020. There were some of us who actually did have a pretty clear view of what might come to be, so...
Well, if it's... Let's get it now while it's on your mind, so if you want to continue on this path, go ahead.
I don't think I will ever forget it, so... Okay. There's no urgency. I think a lot of people who paid attention to some of this know that after the disastrous elections between the first Tuesday in November and the swearing in of Scott Walker on January 4th, there was an attempt to conclude, certainly for state workers, contract negotiations for the 2009 to 2011 biennium to, you know, basically extend contracts for another 6 months while Walker was in office. And, you know, many of us were furiously negotiating to get to resolution, and many of us were extremely frustrated and saying, aha, I told you so, that those contracts had not been negotiated previously, but it's not like Jim Doyle was ever sort of all that interested in, negotiating with state worker unions in any sort of real and direct way. But in any event, Joe Winicky, who had been appointed the head of the Office of State Employment Relations, was a decent human being and someone that I knew. And so I've been trying to work through some back channels with him and with members of the state legislature who ran on our behalf to conclude negotiations for a TAA contract while our bargaining team was going to the table and meeting resistance and all that. And it just so happened that as this was going on, our union, the TAA, was part of a group of AFT-affiliated grad student worker unions. The TAA was the nation's oldest grad student worker union, but by no means the sole one. And so every fall and spring, that group of AFT-affiliated grad student worker unions would get together and have a conference. And it was coming up that I think it was the weekend right after the election, or maybe the weekend right after that, in Ann Arbor. So I'd driven there with a car full of people, and a bunch of us were there. And I was just burning up my cell phone battery, you know, trying to deal with this back channel negotiations on the contract. And and then, you know, that Saturday afternoon hit, and, you know, other people being normal humans being were like, well, I think I'll take the rest of the weekend off. And so I was, you know, agitated and jittery, and one of my close friends and mentors, the president of the faculty union at Milwaukee Area Technical College, AFT Local 212, his name is Michael Rosen, and he's a fellow radical. He and I had said, oh, well, let's talk sometime this weekend when we have some free time. And I, you know, had originally sort of begged off a little bit, like, you know, Michael, I got to make sure I deal with all this stuff, and I'm at this conference, and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, no, we'll figure it out. So there was a 2-hour period in the conference after, you know, I sort of been unable to continue back channel negotiations, where other people in the conference were going to go do something that I really had no interest in. So I got on the phone with Michael, and we talked for almost that whole 2 hours. November 10th, I remember it clearly. We were, taking up this question of, where is there going to be any sort of resistance? And, you know, our analysis was that, you know, working people, you know, from the high level, the grand scheme of things, working people, poor people have been so beaten down that there's been virtually no resistance and no fight back. And, you know, part of the nature of social movements and upsurges and uprisings is that, people are not going to take, when things get bad, things get bad. When things get worse, things get worse. That's not like, well, if things get bad enough, the people will fight back. That's just bullshit. That's not the nature of history. And it's not the nature of human beings, and anyone who's actually gone out and tried to organize to take on real substantive fights would be able to tell you that. So being the hardened organizers and activists that we were, Michael and I were sort of wrestling with what that implied and sort of where there's a potential for some militancy. And, you know, we both sort of agreed, and I don't think this is too brilliant, but that any sort of uprising was going to have to come from the campuses and the proximity of UW to the state capitol, but also of the nature of the TAA and the fact that we had some organizing infrastructure and leadership meant that, you know, we would probably have to play a special role in this, and that we needed to set ourselves out right away for, you know, building for a tremendous fight back. And we didn't know exactly what it was going to be, but we probably needed to figure out a way to engage the potential masses of students around a struggle that mattered. and start to build to make that sort of a defining point in a resistance to Walker, a fight back against the Walker agenda, which had a clear path to maneuver forward. So you're right that hindsight is 20/20, and many of us could look back and say, like, oh, well, you know, we should have seen that he was, you know, out for blood with public employee unions and collective bargaining rights. I don't think anyone's realistic if they say that. But there are some of us who had a very clear view, and I don't think this, you know, presents us as any sort of sage or, you know, brilliant, farsighted people. You know, most of us, I think, who are involved in serious politics think that, you know, or thought that, you know, Walker was going to push a dramatic and extreme agenda, and that it was going to be militant and uncompromising, and that anyone who thought of, you know, conventional politics or had conventional wisdom or views about it was just going to be totally proven to be utterly out of touch with reality, in that, like, oh, well, he won't overreach. I mean, yeah, he's got huge majorities, and he's a reactionary right-wing, you know, quasi-fascist, but he's not going to go full Monty. I mean, he'll face an electoral backlash. I just don't think that's the nature of American politics. But so, you know, I think many of us knew that this was coming, and we needed to steel ourselves for it and figure out a way to organize for a resistance and a fight back. And there were other people as well who did this, but I think we had a view very clearly early on to build something on campus.
Okay. So I've got a few more minutes left.
I want to
back up to the no seg fees, particularly the NAT.
Yeah.
Because I've interviewed a couple of people who've talked about that, so I want to get as much sort of context as I can. So I wonder if you could walk me through, you know, you said it was, well, let's walk me through starting with when you knew, or when as a CA you knew that this was coming, and then how you reacted to it.
So for many of us, segregated fees had been identified a long while previous as like a major issue, because with tuition remission in our contract, that's a crucial material benefit. And when wages for TAs and PAs were so low, like having tuition remission is it almost makes up for that. Mm-hmm. Segregated fees were, you know, being used institutionally as a, you know, as I said before, as a backdoor tuition hike, and this ideological thing about the privatization of universities, which was morally objectionable, personally abhorrent, whatever, abhorrent to us. But it was also, you know, almost $1,000 a year out of our pockets. And so that had been a major priority in terms of bargaining, which, you know, what we weren't making gains on, we knew we weren't going to. And, you know, we had pushed a little bit of a legislative strategy and tried in the state budget to do some things with having the state put money into a fund to pay segregated fees on behalf of grad student workers, and basically force it into the contract that way. And, you know, again, this was going to be something that would take a while to address segregated fees as they were. Mm-hmm. And now there was this proposal to take them from where they were and increase them even more for something to that was, you know, seemingly asinine. A new gym? I mean, this is a world-class university that is slowly being pecked and scratched and clawed apart and systematically defunded from the people down State Street. And you want to use millions of dollars from students, thereby compromising access to this world-class institution for the people of this state, to build a fucking gym? I mean, this just doesn't compute, and any sane and rational person looking at it objectively, you know, from the outside would have been like, God, that's a really dumb idea. And then you sort of have to wonder, what the hell was the administration thinking? And so I think that was our view, is, you know, part of the fight to, you know, and this is, again, the nature of history and social movements, is that oftentimes those that make the biggest gains and make the furthest advances by going on offense are the ones that are rooted in playing defense first and using that as a way to put forward a view and a frame and an analysis of the problem that points to a solution that enables people to go from defense to offense. Now, just for what it's worth, I don't advocate constantly playing defense in the world of movements, and in fact, for much of the left, that is a consistent problem. But this was a real opportunity to take on a defensive battle in a strategic way to then go on offense about segregated fees. And so it was, you know, I think a really important and strategic choice to say, we are going to take this fight on and then use it as a way to build, you know, essentially an anti-seg fee front here in on campus. And so would have been like late winter, early spring when things really started to come together and we had a, you know, essentially a committee of activists and leaders from other student organizations coming together to work on some things coming out of spring break. We wanted to have things together. There was some student government elections as well, too, that, you know, we started to intervene in beyond just the seg fee thing. But, you know, we put together a pretty decent, I would say, a very good campaign and had a strategy for reaching students as voters, turning students into voters and propagandizing and moving votes, just like, you know, you would in a political election. An earned media strategy, you know, a way to tell our story in the campus press. And there was a growing campus politics blog and a blogging scene at the time. And then, you know, we were able to stumble on some interesting information that a reporter from the Associated Press was willing to run with. And I spent a lot of time on the phone sort of walking him through what was going on and why it was objectionable. And to this day, I think my fingerprints are still off that story in public, but I'm outing myself now. Not that it's really outing, but, you know, that the administration had spent, you know, something like $30,000 on this Add Up campaign that was this really sort of ridiculous, overproduced grass, AstroTurf campaign by the you know, UW administration, the athletic department, whatever else, rec sports, to convince students to vote to increase their segregated fees to build this gym for them. And so when we exposed that, that created a whole shitstorm. And, you know, and we just ended up running a better grassroots and field campaign the other side didn't have. And, you know, we moved a lot of people to come out and vote and had, like, a great get-out-the-vote operation on the days of the voting. And, you know, we had a wonderful social media campaign as well, too. You know, that few thousand people like following us. We had an email system that could reach all the UW student voters. And
so what was the what was social media at that time you were using? What were some of the platforms you were using?
Facebook.
Okay.
I think the No New Seg Fees page is still up, although I may have deleted it. I don't remember. It dwindled in terms of the followers, though. Mm-hmm. You know, people just unliked it or whatever.
So I want to make
and the sure T-shirts. The T-shirts are crucial here.
Want to make sure we get the T-shirts on
green
on the
T-shirts
record again.
Oh my god! Yeah.
I mean, that had to be a bit of an expense, though.
Totally, and this is the value of having, you know, an institution around that had resources. The Teaching Assistants Association, as a union of students and workers, was able to be a place physically for us to have a campaign out of. So there's a campaign office. It had a copier. It had computers and phone lines. That matters. it was built in. We had, you know, because of the dues paid by the members of the union, we had, you know, flexible resources to be able to print up literature and purchase T-shirts. And, you know, even buy a list. I think we bought a list to be able to communicate with all the students with a wisc.edu email address. Like, those flexible resources mattered tremendously in that campaign. We had two part-time staff for the union who we could, you know, basically assign for the next, for the, like, the 6-week period of the campaign to work, you know, a bunch of their time on winning the referendum. And that meant they were helping to organize other grad student workers and members of the union to go and participate in things. Like, you know, grassroots politicking, you know, campaigns and organizing is not just spontaneity. It's, you know, directly related to, you know, what sort of resources can be put into things. So that really mattered. And obviously that's something that, you know, sort of touches on what Act 10 did in terms of taking away dues deduction. and all that, and a contract. But yeah, it definitely cost money, but we were able to bring that to the table, and, you know, absolutely thrilled to be able to do so at the time, because it was a great fight to have, and it really did set us on the right path. And there's again, there's a really clear connection between what happened in that fight on the Nonu Seg Feasting, building a, you know, essentially a revived student left on campus, connecting to this fight around a view for what the university ought to be and could be, and building a student worker alliance, and then going from there into the things that were being done on that, you know, the campaign that was coming out of that, that you know, the switch flipped to make it about collective bargaining rights for public employees when this whole shit went down. And, you know, again, this is a preview for next time, and don't think that it's, like, going to escape my mind. But, you know, I firmly and sincerely believe that because the first people to take militant direct action at the Capitol were students, and it cast a non-traditional actor light on what was going on, it opened a whole political space for what the protests could be, and that this could be something that was accessible to the broad masses of people in Wisconsin. And you could have people like my dad who came down to protest, not because I was there so much as it was okay for someone who wasn't a public employee with skin in the game to say, this is outrageous, and this is an attack on values and priorities that have existed in Wisconsin traditions for a long time. Because, you know, students were on the front lines of that at first, or what were seen as students, even though many of us were workers, too, and had something to lose. You know, it created a different political space than if it had been, you know, quote-unquote whiny public employee bureaucrats. No offense to present company intended here. I'm adopting the rights language. If it had just been, you know, state civil servants who made wages high above the median in Wisconsin and had good benefits saying, hey, stop attacking us, it would have been crushed immediately with no real upsurge, no activity. But because it was of a different political character, which again directly related to the organizing and base building work that had been done and the campaigning done leading up to that, that a switch was able to be flipped to transition what we were doing around access to quality, affordable public education and the nature of the university to, look, we have to defend the workers who make this university happen and their rights. And and the political education we've done with students around the role of unions and collective bargaining rights and its link to social movement history. Anyway, we can talk much more about that later, but just have to say that from no new seg fees to the uprising, there's a clear direct line.
Okay. Peter, before we shut down today, so
did we make it through a half the questions you wanted to?
I think we got half at least.
Okay.
Is there anything on your mind, not that you won't be able to say it the next time or remember it, particularly about the time you started with the TAA until, let's say, you know, the inauguration of Governor Walker? So anything from, you know, the fall of 2008 through early 2011 that if you want to talk about, we can talk about it now, or if it comes to your mind, we can make sure we address it.
I don't think it's that big a deal to talk a lot about, but there was a real vibrant and lively debate inside the union about, you know, the future of the union that I think ultimately got some people to be engaged, and, you know, people on opposite sides of the debate from me on some of these things about, you know, how we use dues money, and sort of what we're pushing for and how. And, you know, I think there were some interesting things that came out of that just in terms of people getting involved in developing a view of unionism. Like I said, even though they're on opposite sides of the debate from me, and, you know, my side won. I'm glad that we had the debate. Probably I'm glad because, you know, my side won to a certain extent. But it got some people involved in the union, and you know, that's the nature of democratic unionism, something I was really proud of within the TAA, that, you know, we were a radical, militant, democratic union of the members.
All right, well, let's wrap it up today. So okay. This concludes the first interview with Peter Rickman. Thank you, Peter, for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, today is March 12th, 2015. This is the second interview with Peter Rickman. We are here at Memorial Library. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Archives, and we are interviewing Peter about the 2011 Capitol protests. So Peter, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure. Peter Rickman, R-I-C-K-M-A-N.
Excellent. I'm going to I'm going to turn this up a skosh. All right, we should be. Yeah, we're fine. It's picking me up fine on this side, and I'm farther away. So, as I mentioned before we turned on the recorder, we're going to start right off with the budget repair bill, or sort of the leaking of the idea of the budget repair bill, which was, I think, the Friday before Valentine's Day.
Yeah, Thursday, Friday, something like that.
So I think if you can sort of go back in time a few years, I know you've been through, you know, a busy stretch this legislative season, but if you go back in time, you know, say 4 years, and maybe start by your memories of hearing about that.
Well, I'm not sure if I can remember the sort of where I was, what I was doing, when, as Governor Walker put it, they dropped the bomb. But, you know, in that period of time, there had been a group of us amongst student activists, union activists on campus who had been building towards a longer-term, medium-term campaign around funding of the university system and the way campus workers are treated, their role as students, neoliberalism and austerity played out in the academy. And we had planned for an action to happen on Valentine's Day. I Heart UW, we had sort of these catchy, even kitschy little phrases. I think I still have some of the cards somewhere in my house. But we were going to deliver them to Governor Walker as part of an escalating campaign around the state budget and fighting for higher funding. Because of the ongoing work that had been happening between students and workers, I remember very quickly that night after we first heard about it, a core group of activists and leaders got together and said, you know, we have an obligation, a responsibility, and an opportunity here to take Monday's action and turn it from being about funding for the university into being about the rights of workers. We've done, I'm really proud of the work that we had done, you know, particularly among students in sort of building this consciousness about worker rights and the role of unions and the linkage between, you know, public institutions like higher education, public higher education, and the labor movement, sort of as pillars of a, you know, just and democratic society. And so that debate went really quickly. It wasn't even a debate. Everyone just sort of looked at each other and said, yeah, of course we have to. And, you know, we got to be the leading edge. And, you know, a number of us were obviously, you know, TAA activists who were both students and workers. And as workers, had our rights on the line. And so immediately we swung into gear. And, you know, I think probably the best part about what happened in that immediate lead up to the action on the 14th was that, you know, it was sort of a flowering of leadership where if someone had an idea and it seemed pretty good, you know, said, all right, go do it and make it happen. It wasn't like, you know, the committee needs to review this and then we need to assign the right person and all that. It was just sort of because of the urgency of the situation, it enabled people to step up and play the role of leading through action in a way that I think is the hallmark of the, you know, good social movements. So in any event, we turned to those who had signed our cards. We had, you know, probably a couple thousand of these I Heart UW cards and had been working to gather them even from campuses around the state. We recorded a brief video and put that up on the internet, and it sort of, as they say, went viral, caught a lot of attention and sort of let people know about the Monday action. You know, of course, had a Facebook event that, you know, again took off and had tens of thousands of people actually see it and RSVP to it. But really what made that Monday action happen was collecting the information from those who had signed the cards and just doing the, you know, old-fashioned organizing work of calling people up and saying, we need you to come on out and who else can you bring? And so we had phone banks going throughout the weekend and just recruited extremely heavily. And then on that Saturday, some other students not attached to us decided that they wanted to have an event on the steps of the Memorial Union. And they asked me to come speak. So I did, amongst a couple others. And I remember now Mayor Soglin, then candidate and former Mayor Soglin, showed up and he said something to me. And this is not a direct quotation, obviously, more paraphrasing. He said, you know, when the Vietnam War protests really picked up it was an event just like this, 50 people in attendance, righteous moral outrage, and earnest, passionate people saying that they were going to step up and be part of the fight, even if they weren't themselves directly attached to it because they were students in this particular case, just like in the Vietnam War protests. And he said, mark my words, this is going to be big. And you know, to this day, I give Paul credit for the power of prescience. And so it was smaller things like that event on Memorial Union steps and the hardcore grassroots organizing work and, you know, dedicated activists, if, you know, sort of nameless activists to this point, just people believing in the fight, doing the work to build, you know, some energy and momentum towards that Monday. And so that Monday, as you know, everything was sort of coming together, we're going through the checklists of all the things that needed to happen. We had a crew of people designated to get things set down at Library Mall. I actually went up to the Capitol myself. That was one of my roles, was to go up to the Capitol and just scope out the scene, and actually give a heads up to the Capitol police to let them know, like, this is happening so that we wouldn't have any adverse incidents. And, you know, they sort of acknowledged this was happening. A couple of the Capitol police said, look, this is touching us too. I think it's great that you're doing this. Mm-hmm. And I was extremely nervous. I remember walking up the street towards the Capitol thinking, God, what if, you know, 100 people show up, you know, a whimper, not much of a bang. And I ran into someone who I know and told him, hey, you coming to the thing? He's like, no, I'm not. I mean, do you think it's really going to do anything anyway? And I just thought to myself, I don't know. I'll get back to you about that. And so this palpable, heavy feeling of anxiety and dread and nervousness sat in me. And so when I was in the Capitol, I got word that people were getting close and said, how does it look? And they were like, looks pretty amazing. We have 2,000 people here. And I was like, wow, really? And I stepped outside the doors of the Capitol, and there were 2,000 people showing up, and I could see people in the front that I knew, you know, campus union activists, faculty, academic staff, and obviously hundreds of students and you know, activist people that I knew. But what really struck me, and I remember to this day, is seeing faces that I was like, who are these people? Just people showing up to join the fight, join the struggle. And when we came inside, it was, you know, booming loud. I mean, I'm sure there's videos that record this far better than any words that I could share about it. And you know, I addressed the crowd briefly before we went inside with a bullhorn. Went inside, you know, we're loud and raucous in the rotunda, you know, presaging a lot of what would come from there. That was sort of a center of activity. Then we marched our way up to Governor Walker's office, and you know, I sort of expected there would be a little bit of a police presence to keep us out, but we ended up right in that hallway in the first floor east wing going into the governor's office. And we jam-packed it, and there were television cameras all around. And, you know, we had these boxes of Valentines to deliver to the governor, and we brought them and just dumped them right out after asking if the governor would come on. And obviously, the spokesperson said no, and I remember being face-to-face with the governor's spokesman, and you know, it was pretty impossible to understand one another. So I don't even know what I said. I don't really know what he said. It was just so loud, and there was so much energy bouncing off those marble walls and the hot lights of the television cameras and all that right there. And you know, we delivered. There's I think a fairly iconic picture of Joe Kuo, Kyle Vanden Langenberg, and me, you know, holding up these Valentines. And I'll always remember that. Thankfully, my wife kept a copy of the newspaper from that day. It was, or the next morning, the State Journal. And that was, it was sort of a defiant moment of we're bringing the fight right to you, and it's not the people you expect. It's not the municipal workers and the teachers. It's students and workers who see themselves as part of a broader fight for social and economic justice. Truly, that's what it was. Otherwise, it never would have gotten to that point with so many non-traditional actors. And we're ready to fight you. And it's not going to be just sort of we're calling our legislators and sending them emails and hoping the legislative process works out. You know, we're playing by a different set of rules here with, you know, more militant direct action. And I think that experience and that direct confrontation and challenge actually gave people some of the sense of what needed to be done, what could be done. They had a feeling of their own power. When you have 2,000 people in that Capitol, and it was unprecedented at the time, And I think people had the sense that, you know, something was going to be different about this. It wasn't just a standard set of 50 regular activist types showing up and having a little protest. This was the start of a mass movement. You know, I'm probably forgetting a bunch of the details because now it's been 4 years and all that. But, you know, we ended up, after the confrontation at the governor's office, we went outside and marched around. And I think we ended up on the north exit to the Capitol. And I did a small speak out about what was going on. And, you know, I gave mildly coherent story about why, you know, this fight mattered to me and why I was a part of it. And, you know, that it wasn't just about any one of us. It was sort of, this is a fight for the soul of Wisconsin. And that's why we were a part of this. And we weren't going to just let it be one thing. We were going to come back. And I meant every word of that. And I think people who were there meant every word of it too, when they, you know, nodded in assent and cheered. And that set the stage for the next period of time around, you know, further activity at the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, roughly 2000 the first day, but it's really Tuesday that it mushrooms from 2000 to, you know, thousands and thousands of people. Well, I guess maybe just walk us through what you remember about, you know, you got done with the Monday event. You said you were coming back, so I assume mm-hmm. you plan on coming back. What are your memories of that next day?
Well, one is there was a lot going on. You know, there were buses of county and municipal workers, and in particular teachers, coming down that day to the Capitol. And setting up for big rallies to happen in the middle of the day, and then in particular at the end of the day. I don't think at that point in time any of the teacher unions from around the state had called for, you know, basically what amounted to a strike. Mm-hmm. I don't think that had happened yet for that day, but there were just tons that were showing up. And that was also the day that the Joint Finance Committee was basically doing testimony and a hearing on the budget repair bill. So you had a steady stream of people going in to do that. And I believe I registered to testify, but it was just buried amongst, you know, literally thousands of people who were there to testify in this. And I remember there being some pretty moving testimony from people about what the cuts were going to do to them, what their union meant to them, and how getting rid of this was, you know, awful for them. But it all sort of summed up into this, you know, unconscionable deviation from at least 50 years of public employee unionism in Wisconsin, and sort of a departure from the idea of Wisconsin as a state with, you know, reasonably progressive governance and recognition of the rights of workers and the importance of public institutions playing a positive role in people's lives. There was a bunch happening that day. I recall at some point in time there were some of us, maybe it was, yeah, I think it was that day where we had a lot more people showing up at the TAA office because it was sort of becoming known as a center of activism. Like, you know, we had been doing those phone banks to build for the 14th. and we just put people to work, you know, making phone calls to people to mobilize them to turn out. Getting people recruited to go out into districts of legislators. And some of these were, you know, an hour plus away, recruiting people to go out into these districts. So we were consciously part of an effort to, you know, have the Capitol be a center of activity, but also to spread out, you know, into the parts of the state where we needed to build the struggle as well, too. As the day went on and the testimony kept going, I got in my head, you know, one, there's a lot of people here, and there's a pretty clear and direct confrontation with the political leadership of the state right now by ordinary, everyday people. Not just, you know, your committed activists who'd be there, but like folks that spontaneously, autonomously, you know, got themselves into the struggle, into motion. And that was not going to recede, and that there was a decent chance that that confrontation could escalate and that it might, you know, because of the Joint Finance Committee hearing and the rally happening that night, it might, you know, explode and then continue on. So I actually went home and got like a toothbrush, and I don't think I got a pillow, but change clothes, thinking to myself, I might be here a little bit longer. And that was, you know, sort of prescient. It wasn't like there was any intention, all right, we're going to get a bunch of people in the Capitol and we're going to occupy it. Mm-hmm. That did arise relatively spontaneously and in the moment. But, you know, I had just a sense in my head something like that might happen. And the testimony kept going in front of the, excuse me, in front of the Finance Committee. And, you know, and then they said they were going to shut it down. And there were, I don't know, probably 500 to 1,000 of us up on the fourth floor outside of the Joint Finance Committee hearing room. And when we heard this, I remember running around the fourth floor because that's where a bunch of people were. And if you know the Capitol, it's not easy to navigate your way around there. And on in one of the other large rooms on the fourth floor, that was sort of an overflow room. And there were a bunch of, you know, leaders from public employee unions in there and rank and file activists watching stuff. And when they said they were going to shut it down, I just tore around the fourth floor saying, they're shutting it down. We gotta go. And brought a bunch of people up towards the doors of the Finance Committee hearing room, which they had shut and locked. And the feeling I remember there was, oh my God, it's really hot. and you know, with so many people in there, you started to get really sweaty really quickly, actually. And, you know, we were chanting and stomping around. And, you know, I don't know if I lost my voice really quickly, but one thing I remember is that, you know, from starting to lead chants, you could see other people were willing to step up and to do the same. And in a moment like that, that's actually a really big thing, because otherwise your energy can dissipate. And it just kept building and building, and more people kept showing up and filling that space. And there were some political operatives, you know, some like union political staff who were around. And, you know, in some ways, like, I think they were sort of dumbfounded by what was happening with the Act 10 thing, weren't really sure what to do. And that's not a criticism of them, but to their credit, there's a few of them that immediately spring to mind. They snapped into action and they went and got water and brought up these cases of water so that people could, you know, one, rehydrate from all the yelling and chanting that we were doing, and also to cool off a little. And you know, it was those little things like that throughout what, you know, became the Capitol occupation that sustained people, and that always will stick out in my mind, is that in the moment people stepped up, whether it was to be chant leaders or, you know, whatever else, to bring in water to people who were right there. And it was a pretty intense sort of thing, and I don't know how it all came about, but the Assembly and Senate Democrats decided that they were going to, even if the Republicans wouldn't continue the hearings, they'd continue the hearings. And this was sort of a moment of tremendous uncertainty. And I don't know if the Capitol operations people and the Capitol police really knew what to do. So they, I think probably in hindsight, they would say maybe didn't make the right decision, but their hand was forced with so many people so angry that the Republicans were going to push through this, you know, unprecedented assault on working people without so much as even finishing the hearing and the testimony. And so they kept the Capitol open. The Democrats announced they were going to continue doing the hearing, even if it wasn't official. And anyone who was there to speak was going to be able to speak. And, you know, it just sort of was like, oh, well, I guess we're staying in. I don't think people consciously thought of as an occupation of the Capitol at that point in time. But there was like, there was a press conference that the Democrats called, and Stephanie Bloomingdale, the Secretary Treasurer of the state AFL-CIO, who I knew and know, still came in and grabbed me and was like, these politicians are going to, you know, jump out in front of this. We have to have this be about working people who are fighting for themselves. And it just, you know, one of those things that continues to stick into my mind. And it's an ongoing thing, in, you know, amongst progressive forces about, you know, who's out front on these fights. Is it Democratic politicians, or is it activists and movement people? But that press conference happened. You know, the Democrats, to their credit, announced they were going to continue these hearings, and they went and set up. And a smaller group of us went back to room 300 Northeast, which was a room that AFT Wisconsin, the state federation for my union at the time, TAA, had rented, or not rented, but had sort of booked. And that had then morphed its way into being, you know, protest headquarters. A smaller group of us went back there, and some senior movement leaders, union leaders, people with whom I'm actually very, very close, 60 plus years old veterans, left-wing veterans of the union movement, facilitated a discussion about what are we going to do. And through the course of that, there was, it's a lot of grad students, so everyone's got to say everything at least once, and, probably more than that too. And it was clear there's a consensus, like, we need to continue to occupy this building, and we're going to fight and be as militant as we need to. And at one point in time, I was like, I got up and said something, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but it's like, look, it's clear we're going to do this. We've got hundreds of people in this Capitol right now, not knowing what's going on. We need to go rally the troops. We need to exercise some leadership and tell them we're going to stay. Are you in? And give them the confidence that there is some direction to this, and that doing what they're doing, which is outside the comfort level of any ordinary person, basically a militant occupation, is the right thing to do. If you're the housewife from Altoona who showed up because, you believe in fighting for your husband's union, or you're the guy who's, been getting health insurance because your nurse wife has had a good public employee job, and you want to protect that for yourself and your kids, and that's why you're protesting. What you're doing here is a legitimate thing to do. And so I remember going around into the mezzanine, where people had started to set up, and some of them had thought ahead too and brought their own pillows and whatever. We're staying. This is the right thing to do. We're gonna occupy this Capitol. And so it was a a series of things along the way, people stepping up as leaders through their activism, not because they were self-appointed or someone named them a leader, but people leading through action. Creating this situation where people were going to launch an occupation, and not just a bunch of committed radicals, but ordinary everyday people, saying this is how they were going to fight, because playing by the rules was going to leave us, basically rolled over. So it was in some ways a pretty heady way to start an occupation, and then it was ongoing throughout the night, and I remember sleeping for about an hour and a half in room 300 Northeast. We sort of had this collective decision to turn out the lights, and people who wanted to sleep could sleep. And, most of us, grabbed about an hour and a half of shut eye. And not a very comfortable night sleeping under a table with a bag like this for a pillow. But we were then occupying a state capitol.
And that room, became like... I've heard that room talked about as sort of the hub of activism. Also, the TAA was there, so that's the place that others have talked about as being the place that sort of becomes the room.
Yeah, it was. If the Capitol was a center of activity in this multifaceted, multi-layered Wisconsin uprising of 2011, in some ways, room 300 Northeast was the nerve center for what was happening in that center. Now, there were also things like at the Concourse Hotel, where the official union movement had a bunch of rooms, and people were set up there, and sort of proceeding on a couple of different fronts and different paths as well. But for the Capitol occupation, room 300 Northeast was it. And gradually over time, what you saw happen was that wasn't just a gathering place or a place to plug in your phone or your laptop and charge it, but food and beverage got set up in there, and then crock pots and whatnot out in the hallways, and it became part of a self-sustaining, in some ways, ecosystem. People knew that was where you go to if you wanted to bring food, or if you wanted to order pizza, or if you're a notable of some sort. Like, when you come to Madison, that's where you go to. Like, Tom Morello came in and hung out and talked to people there, and Senator Baldwin, Tammy Baldwin, came in and talked to people there. And it's like, that was sort of the place where you knew that things were happening that impacted the whole of the occupation, but it was also the place where, like, some of the most committed and early activists were sort of centered as well.
So when did you go back home? And when did you leave again, I guess?
I think that next morning I went home to... Once there was, a good size crowd starting to gather, I went home, laid on my bed for about 45 minutes, fed the dogs, and took a shower, and I came back there. I was probably gone for about 90 minutes all told, and then back to the Capitol. Now, this is where all the days start to merge together in my mind. Not just 4 years on, but as I've thought about it, like, God, I couldn't tell Wednesday apart from Thursday apart from Friday of that week. Other than just knowing that at one point in time, there's this tremendous surge of energy and momentum with, you know, basically like teachers calling what amounted to a statewide teacher strike.
So let's talk about a couple of things here, which might get us through the rest of our time. If not, I have obviously more to ask. So how are you, you know, as you said, this sort of all morphs into one. You know, after those initial memories, it all sort of morphs into one. But how are you balancing in general, you know, being a TA and being at the Capitol during this time? So my first direct question would be, you know, did you have a class? Did you... What was your semester like before, you know, February 11th?
I didn't go to class for the entirety of that occupation time. And I was fortunate enough to have some professors who were understanding, if not of, you know, the struggle and the fight, at least my absolute commitment to it. And they were willing to work with me. One of the classes that I was taking, extremely ironically, was a public sector labor law class. And the faculty person for that class allowed me to, you know, essentially like hold on doing my assignments, provided I was willing to, one, complete the assignments, but then also add some reflection to that. I was also a student attorney with the Neighborhood Law Project. I think it's now called the Neighborhood Law Clinic. And the faculty advisor for that, you know, sort of arranged some things with me there where the cases that I was working on, where there wasn't urgent things, I could just sort of toll the work until, you know, things became a little clearer about what was going to happen. And then with the cases where there was some urgent things, we were always in pairs, and that my paired person could take the lead on some of those. But he had this other thing, too, that, like, you know, I wasn't just going to get off whatever, but I had to write, like, nightly reflections and send them to him, and we can maybe get into this, but like I did sitting in the office of Representative Corey Mason, which I used as a place where some nights I slept in there because I could, you know, sort of get actual sleep in there, sleeping on the carpeted floor. Anyway, we can get into that more, but I remember doing those with the lights turned off around me and just typing away and being so exhausted that I couldn't even really think straight. But I was, you know, by God, I was going to fulfill my responsibilities because I had these understanding professors. I was not a TA at the time. I was a project assistant, which is, you know, also part of what was then the bargaining unit. And again, my employer was totally understanding and willing to sort of let things happen. Just so happened that the funder for that project that I was working on was AFSCME District Council 40, one of the, you know, large public employee unions. And so the staff leadership and my supervisor who was overseeing the project from District Council 40 showed up, you know, they were obviously there early on, and they're, you know, it was just sort of a knowing thing, like, so you're not coming in, right? Like, it's more important that you're here, and we'll figure out the rest of the project on the back end, which we did. But I was extremely fortunate that the people who were sort of part of my academic and work life at the time understood. Like I said, most of them sort of, you know, down for the cause, believed in the struggle, but also just sort of understanding that I was playing a leadership role and that there was no way I was not going to continue doing that, and that I was willing to accept the consequences, and they were willing to make those consequences different than just simply a punishment kind of thing. So it was fortunate, but also as I sit here and, you know, think out loud a little, some of it is just based upon the choices that I had made as a student and whatever. Like, I put myself in a position where I was with people who were, you know, good like that. So I didn't go to work, didn't go to school for about 2.5 weeks.
But in some senses, and maybe the people that were, you know, your supervisors, the faculty, the people that were sort of overseeing what would have been your work, I mean, it was an education in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this is an important thing, too. At the time, you know, a number of the faculty and academic staff on campus, partly because of some of the organizing we were doing, themselves got in motion around this and, you know, did some, I remember now as the TAA, we organized basically a teach out. So instead of people doing classes, lectures, discussion sessions on campus, that they should bring them to the Capitol or bring them off campus and then bring the people who are willing amongst the students to the Capitol. And so, you know, there was just, there was a moment in time there where a number of the people in supervisory positions dealing with, you know, grad students, grad student workers, were part of the struggle too. And, you know, I think that's what happens in these movement moments where people get caught up in what's happening in a good way, and they find themselves in the struggle and find what they can do in the struggle.
So how are you balancing then being at the Capitol and home?
I am married to a woman who is incredible in any number of different ways, which is why I was fortunate enough to be able to convince her to marry me. But she knew going into this what, you know, my commitment was going to be, and was extremely, not just understanding, but supportive, and would, you know, bring me food. And my brother lives in town, and, you know, she and he would figure out how to, you know, get me some things, or, you know, just come and be supportive. And, you know, that when there were a couple moments where we were building towards points of escalation and nonviolent direct action, civil disobedience, where the risk of arrest was real, and, you know, many of us had made the decision that was something we were willing to do, you know, she was really anxious, but also, again, very supportive and understanding of this being, you know, part of my life and part of our life together. So I couldn't have been more empowered because of the partnership with my wife. And, you know, just, you know, we had, to that point, always had just sort of, I don't want to say like difficulty in our marriage and partnership with the degree of activism I'd been involved with and the tensions it put on our time together. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that had always been something of a struggle, and we were always committed to working through it, and you know, still are. Mm-hmm. So it was tougher than normal, but it wasn't like it was something she wasn't used to. And, you know, just she made it easy for me. And the rest of my family was also extremely supportive too. Like I said, my brother, who doesn't necessarily have, like, certainly doesn't have any kind of left-wing politics like I do, was very supportive and said, you know, whatever you need, I'm here for you. And, you know, was great throughout. And I remember one night when I had a bag with me, and I couldn't have the bag with me because there was this moment of potential civil disobedience leading to the risk of arrest. He took it. And that's like those little things, again, that enable people to lead in the moment and create these larger, more powerful moments. My in-laws, who, when I first met them, were Fox News-watching Republicans and now are, you know, pro-union, pro-worker people to a large degree, came and joined the protests. My parents, and, you know, my mom was a public employee at the time, you know, small, soft-spoken woman from Neenah, Wisconsin, came down, and I remember her finding, we found each other, and her friend, who was a retired teacher from Menasha, found each other in the Capitol, and we stumbled upon our state representative. And my mother, all 5'6" of her, you know, went up to this guy and basically got in his face and was like, "You cannot do this." And it was this intense moment, and I just hung back and watched a lot of pride. I've never seen this sort of degree of politicization. You basically went after this guy, and he ended up being one of the people who voted against it. And I, you know, to this day, as a Republican, I think he's a decent human being. He voted the right way for the right reasons. He said, "Look, Pat, I'm voting against this." The reason I bring that up in follow-up to your question is, when things started, I was actually a little nervous about the reaction of my family, my parents, you know, sort of straight-laced conventional people. And my dad, for his part, and there's a longer backstory to this, but, you know, for the purposes of what we're doing here, he bargained for management on the other side of the table from actually what ended up being my mom's union. And he came down and protested too. And I hadn't really talked to them a whole lot since the occupation began to that point. But it was their presence and their willingness to show up and their willingness to be, you know, activists in their own right there that just gave me a sense that, you know, not only is this, as I was convinced, the righteous thing to do and something that absolutely needed to happen and I had a role to play in it, but I was supported, you know, whether it was my wife, who's extremely supportive and even participatory in some respects because of the degree of her support, but the whole of my family was too. And these are not your, you know, left-wing trade union activists. They're normal, everyday Northeastern Wisconsin people to be part of this. And so that gave me a support system and network that was crucial for my own participation.
Well, maybe let's take a second then, since you referenced, your home representative or your mom and dad, where you grew up and your mom and dad live. So you mentioned earlier that you ended up spending some time in Representative Mason, I believe you said.
Yeah.
So how did that all come about?
I had known Corey before then. He had actually been the political director for AFT Wisconsin, and then had run for office. And we shared a number of friends in common, and so we had gotten to know each other over the preceding years and worked together on some political things. And the person who was like his lead staff person was someone I'd known for years in Madison, too. And she had actually written a letter of recommendation for me to law school. She's a graduate of the law school and actually had been one of my references for my application to the Neighborhood Law Project. And she had been a participant in that previously. So working with the two of them, as an elected official and the staff person to an elected official, I think really got what to me the role of people in those positions ought to be. It was to foster and support frontline activists, protagonists, I guess is the term du jour, of directly affected people playing the leadership role, and that, you know, they should, as elected officials and staff people, support that. And so, you know, Corey and Vicky, Vicky Selko is her name, basically opened up their office and said, you know, if you need to sleep here, you need a place to charge your phone, you need a place to leave your bag throughout the day, 6 North is it. And so, you know, I took them up on that. And my wife brought a sleeping bag. I ended up getting it back, you know, 9 months later and left it there. But I was able to sleep in that office a number of nights throughout the occupation. And, you know, I think Corey's a wonderful human being and a great elected official. And he's a great leader because he consistently knows and understands his role to play in the movement at large. And at that point in time, his role was to, make it possible for one of the activists to do this. And at different times during the uprising, he played a different role, too. He spoke at one of the rally on that Tuesday night, right before John Nichols gave a powerful speech. So, you know, and to me, the lesson is, you know, movements have many faces, movements have many participants, and what makes them successful in the moment and over the long haul is people stepping up to play the leadership role that's appropriate at any given time. And sometimes it's stepping forward, sometimes it's stepping back, sometimes it's supporting people, and sometimes it's asking for support. And that was a great example to me of what, you know, someone could do.
So maybe just briefly then more on, since you know, you said you didn't necessarily have to go to class, but they still asked things of you.
Mm-hmm.
So these sort of daily missives or daily reflections. I'm not asking you to recite any, but, you know, sort of a basic idea of what sort of things you were writing on those days.
First person accounts of what was going on, and. You know, some degree of analysis about why those things were happening, and then analysis of the broader situation. Something to the extent of predictions about how things might continue or what might happen. And the truth is, they were really brief, because, you know, when you're only sleeping a few hours a night, and you're sleeping on, you know, in some cases marble floor, sometimes on carpet over the top of marble, you're not sleeping particularly well. So, you know, I don't know if you've ever been sleep deprived for, you know, extended period of time, more than a few days, actually, you know, your brain starts to get a little soft and fuzzy. So it's not like there was a whole lot to them more than just those basic elements and very Hemingway-esque plain sentences.
Mm. So, in one sense, this was not your, or mine, or yours, our mother's protest. By that I mean, we live in an age where, you know, you can be plugged in all the time. So it's not like the protests of the Vietnam era where, you know, you'd go home and sort of see what was on the news, or, you know, you could check the news right there in your hand. So the first question is about technology in general. How do you think technology, either personally or in general, affected what was going on in the Capitol during those days?
I think, I'm sure you've probably heard different answers to this from a bunch of different people, and I suspect that the balance of them has lauded or played up the role of technology more so than what I think is a crucial part of this. I mean, you know, I specifically referenced it before when talking about building for the 14th that, you know, we had a Facebook event invite and heavy use of email that, you know, I think certainly helped foster some of the participation and attendance. But it was more about the buzz building and the wraparound communication to people that you know, got them to see that this was a big thing and that they should and could be part of it and wouldn't be isolated. But, you know, if there's any technological thing that mattered most during that, to me it was probably the combination of some of the things that were being posted on Facebook simply as storytelling, not necessarily as an organizing and mobilizing tool. I think that it probably helped in that respect, but it was direct first-person accounts of what was going on that sort of took on a life of their own, because people could be their own media to some extent, that enabled us to not be immediately marginalized by a traditional media that really didn't have the faculty or understanding to truly do justice to what was going on there. I think that was particularly helpful. And then also just like text messages. For me, that was big. My phone didn't work too well in the Capitol in terms of audio reception, but I could text message people, and that was a way to communicate. And, mm-hmm. you know, even though we're, you know, thousands of people in this relatively small space, you know, when you're inside the Capitol, it's pretty big. There's four wings and four floors, and it's hard to get around. So being able to communicate like that was certainly helpful. But to me, I think the most important aspect of communication was actually being in the place. And seeing people, talking to people, knowing you could go find them. It's that presence, and again, I keep referencing a center of activity that was sort of this living, breathing example of and reality of militancy, direct confrontation with power, and unwillingness to abide by traditional rules. And in any event, I guess to me the role of technology was relatively secondary, more buttressing the... a lot of the things that that good organizing is built on, and my experience since then, you know, working as you know, an organizer, and this was true before this as well too, is that, you know, there's no substitute for actually talking to a person actively as opposed to passive communication through email or Facebook or whatever else. But I don't want to downplay at all the importance of the first person storytelling of what was happening. And sporadic moments where, like, a Facebook post about they're shutting down the Capitol, everyone get there, being helpful because it was immediate. Mm-hmm. You didn't have time to ramp up a phone bank and call 10,000 people. You'd put that out and 100 people could share it, and it created this, you know, sense of urgency on its own. But I don't think technology on its own was, like, this big mobilizer.
So maybe a couple more things for this time.
Mm-hmm.
Your memories, if any, of the 14, like when you heard that they had left, what it meant to you, if anything. It's just one of the things that sort of comes up as word association, so I wonder if you could spend a moment on that.
Yeah, that was huge. I mean, we live in a pretty passive political system here in terms of the activities of elected officials, where it's a pretty straight-laced, straightforward kind of thing where, you know, elected officials are not A, movement actors, and B, certainly confined, self-confined to parliamentary maneuvers. So the 14 leaving the state as an extra parliamentary maneuver
sort of reflecting what was happening in the Capitol and happening around the state with, you know, far less traditional modes of political engagement was supremely important because it validated the militancy and the direct action nature of a Capitol occupation and like I said, everything else. And it put them in the same sphere as the rank and file protagonists as engaging in what amounted to nonviolent direct action of their own. It was civil disobedience. I mean, that's why they crossed state lines so that they couldn't be tracked down. And stories of how they made their way out of town sort of became, you know, momentary legend and lore. And I think, you know, it put trade union activists and our allies and the Democrats into a position of unity that I think oftentimes is assumed but isn't actually real. And so you had politicians taking a risk. And again, I can't underemphasize the extra parliamentary nature of it. Their willingness to basically leave the parliamentary field and cross state lines and remain there actually stalled things and created a moment not just based upon the energy and momentum being generated from this unity of activity, but also just in terms of chronology. There was enough time for more and more people to mobilize with this validation and legitimacy, which then spawned something of a nationwide thing where you had, you know, the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor chartering a plane and bringing rank and file activists in. You had Tom Morello and the Dropkick Murphys coming in. You had union and progressive activists coming in from all over. You had cultural figures aligned with us coming in. You had Ed Schultz showing up and basically setting up broadcast, you know, a traditional media figure and many others. Putting a spotlight on what was happening, the attack on worker rights, this generational assault on unions, and the fight back that people were engaged in, the activity of the 14 Democratic senators made that possible, and that cannot be underestimated. It's the tactical things that amount to a larger strategy that sort of evolves on the ground. That was incredible. And then you could look to those Democratic senators as playing a leadership role in their own right. Now, I think there's also a lot of conflict with the nature of Democratic politicians and sort of the roles that they end up playing or parlay that momentary, you know, correct and heroic activity into something else over the long haul. But, you know, in the moment, that was so crucial and it can never be underestimated. And like I said, it was truly heroic because they took a risk. They put themselves in the line. They opened themselves up to their own recalls because of that. Mm-hmm. In addition to the withering criticism of the right wing and even some more traditional media who simply does not understand extra parliamentary maneuvering in our political system. Yes, it was absolutely crucial and a really important part of everything that was happening. It wasn't just a thing unto itself. It intersected with everything else that was going on in the Capitol and around the state.
Again, an understanding, as you said, that these things, after that initial sort of flurry of memory, all sort of meld into one. You mentioned earlier that just now that those senators leaving put themselves up to possibly being recalled. Do you recall during this period when the idea of recall of Republican senators and eventually the recall, possible recall of the governor, do you recall when you started hearing about that?
I recall vaguely this idea coming forward, and this is an utter misconception about how this all eventually played out, so I want to make sure to touch on that. But I remember the idea coming out from some of the political operatives from the official union movement trying to think about, you know, how do we carry this forward? And it wasn't like, oh, well, let's channel all this movement activity into the bourgeois electoral arena, as some Marxist critics from this campus have tried to levy. It was just sort of looking around, like, what can we do to escalate this? And the idea was to cease playing by the rules of those who have constructed a system that allow them to take away the rights of workers under color of law. And no one had really done recalls before, certainly not on such a large scale. And so this idea, amongst others, was out there. And the truth is, it started to percolate around those who were at the Capitol and activists from across the state, and it took on a currency of its own where people were like, yeah, this makes sense. This is something we ought to do. This is exciting. We can... Each one of us can continue the fight. If I can't occupy the state capitol indefinitely, you know, and no one knew it was going to be, you know, 17 days at that point in time, this is something I can go and participate in. This is a role that I can play in the movement, and the movement itself can have a political character that translates into effective change, not just symbolic protest, but substantive change. And so it became something that that I think from the moment it was hatched, it wasn't presaged that this was something that was going to be the way forward, but it took on a currency amongst activists. And I'll say this, there were a number of tactical and strategic options on the table, and I was at that time an elected vice president of the AFT Wisconsin State Federation, and we had a vote on our executive committee. I participated by phone, and I remember where I was standing to try to sort of be inside, but because of my cell phone reception, I had to sort of be outside, and it was extremely cold. I remember standing where I was to participate in the phone conference. We had a vote on whether the state fed was going to call for a strike of all the units, of all the locals. And, you know, I argued for calling for a strike and working with other unions to do that. And the rank and file leadership of the union disagreed. Like, you know, the vote went down, and there was maybe one or two other people who voted with me in favor of a strike. But that's the nature of unionism, is that tactical options are considered, and the member leaders make the decisions. So it's not like recall was foisted upon people as the only way. It was put forward as one potential option amongst a number of others. And in that moment, people seeing extra parliamentary and parliamentary action as more complementary than divergent. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this took on a currency, and the national union types were wary. They saw it as something that could work, but also something that could blow up in our face. They were concerned about what was happening in other states. They didn't quite get the whole thing because it's legally, you know, and it's rooting in the state statute. It's not something that most people are familiar with. It's, again, it's sort of off the wall, out of bounds of normal political activity, even parliamentary political activity. But it was embraced by the rank and file, the grassroots of the movement. And over the course of the next period of time, people embraced that and took it up as a thing that they could do themselves. And it was truly led by grassroots activists and ordinary, everyday people. We ran canvases out of the TAA office to go get this set up. But, you know, that was one example of probably dozens of sort of self-directed things. And some of the progressive the infrastructure of progressive forces, you know, Democratic and Labor and other progressive allies, their organizations, you know, provided some guidance and support to make that thing work. But it was entirely grassroots driven throughout the decision making about the initial round of recalls and gathering the signatures and all that. And obviously, you know, things couldn't happen immediately with Scott Walker the way they could with the state senators. But there was another period of time with a lot of hemming and hawing and decision making about what to do in terms of recalling Scott Walker, whether to do so, when to do so, etc. And, you know, in my mind, as, you know, something of a first person participant observer, it, you know, directly contradicts a lot of those who would critique from the left the turn towards doing recalls as a, you know, as an actual strategy, political or otherwise. But I think I know who originally birthed the idea, and because of looking into this. But I just want to continue to underscore the point that this is something that was embraced and taken up by the grassroots, not just as an idea, but then put into action. And that's your best validator of tactical choices, is do the people take it up? And the people took it up.
We had a couple more minutes here.
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about, I'm sure we'll talk more about the 17 days next time along, okay, with then sort of looking ahead to recalls. But I want to make sure I get your thoughts on this, since this is the root of the topic today. Your memories of the vote when the Senate voted.
After the 14 had come back?
The when they sort of decoupled, or whatever you want to call it, when they stripped away enough of the bill that they were able to vote on it,
yeah,
without a quorum.
I have virtually no recollection of it, other than people trying to be in the
the lobby of the Senate chambers, and you know, trying to block the doors and all that kind of stuff. But it's one of those things that my memory is blurred from, because there were a number of parliamentary activities happening in terms of, you know, the Democrats holding it in the assembly where they're wearing their orange shirts for like, what, 64 hours or something like that. Like, I have no recollection of that happening as it went down. I have no recollection of exactly when that conference committee thing happened, where Peter Barca sort of stormed off and, you know, blew things up because of the process. I remember that they happened, and obviously now looking back 4 years on, you know, I have certain images in my head, but of the times when those things were happening, that's just more that sort of blurs in my mind. I can pick out other specific instances of things happening that we probably will never get to because they're so, you know, minimally important. But I really couldn't tell you anything about that. Other than it pissed me off.
So maybe to end, and you just sort of mentioned the fact that there you have these micro memories, if you will, of events. But now that we've been talking for almost an hour, are there things about those 17 days that are specific in your mind that you want to make sure sort of get on the record, if you will?
Sure. So when... I mean, I have these memories of Jesse Jackson showing up. And I'm like a Jesse Jackson fan because I'm a student of political history, and his 1984 and 1988 presidential campaigns and what was happening with the Rainbow Coalition are, like, in my mind, sort of seminal moments in progressive politics. And so Jesse Jackson showing up, oh my God, this is huge. Not just because he's Jesse Jackson, but because of the role that he's played in left-wing progressive politics. But also a number of... Because I'm a trade unionist at heart. Like, I'm a person of labor. So when Rich Trumka showed up, the president of the National AFL-CIO, that was like a big deal. That was a huge validator. And like some of the national staff were like, they set up this meeting between us. And it was really cool to be like, oh, you're a person that Rich Trumka wants to talk to. And I had on, you know, I have this Buffalo plaid checked flannel jacket, and I had a blaze orange winter hat on. It's like, you know, it's sort of like this, you know, Northwoods look. That there's this great picture of after the meeting that he and I had, I'm wearing this, and we carry to the Capitol these trays, these huge commercial, you know, culinary operation trays of brats that people from the building trades had been cooking. We carried them into the Capitol to feed the people, me and Rich Trumka, and you know, a bunch of other people, but like, it's those hilarious moments. And then the national president of the international president of the United Steelworkers, which is a union that has not just a special place in my heart, but an importance to my life because of, you know, who they represent in the Fox Valley where I grew up, the paper workers, and it just, you know, their history and tradition as a union. Like Leo Gerard, the president, like, you know, wanted to meet me, and I had a chance to meet him. And it, you know, in the course of doing that, it was just like, oh my God, this guy's, you know, totally a hero to me, and he's here and he's joining our fight. Then I don't know if this name has come up, but there's a fellow that lived in Madison at the time. His name's Ed Sadlowski, and he worked for AFSCME. Before that, he'd worked for MTI. In between, he had worked out in California for a union there. Ed Sadlowski is the son of oil can Eddie Sadlowski. And with a name like Sadlowski, you know he's Polish, and I'm Polish, but you can't tell from my last name, because it's my dad's, but you know, my family's from Poland, off the boat. And oil can Eddie had led this insurgent, rank and file led uprising in the steelworkers in the 70s, and he showed up to be part of the fight, and supporting, you know, his son Ed, who's a staff rep and all that. And I got to meet, you know, oil can Eddie Sadlowski. This is a, you know, rank and file union activist who made big waves, and was sort of one of those people who, if the union movement had followed, I don't think we'd be in the position that we're in today. So, you know, I got to meet some of these amazing people who showed up there to be part of the struggle, and like at a certain currency of being a person they wanted to talk to and meet, and that was just a really heady moment. So those are some of the things that stick out to me, because they're like, you know, they're very personal and all that. But, you know, if I sat here and thought about it and just yammered on for a while, which I guess is the nature of oral history, right? I could probably come up with 100 other things that were just, like, amazing moments that happened in the Capitol. Oh, like the first time the firefighters marched in and came into the rotunda. And James Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa's kid, marched with them and, you know, gave this big speech to the people in the rotunda. And, like, it's hard to hear, but he had a microphone and there was a speaker there. And I held the speaker on my shoulder for Jimmy Hoffa to give a speech right after this powerful, compelling, emotional moment when the firefighters marched in with their bagpipes. So it's things like that. Oh, Mary Kay Henry, the president of SEA, who now I've gotten to know much more, came to show her support and spoke at a rally and had a rank and file SEIU activist speak at one of the rallies. She came in to do a thing in the rotunda, and I like did this introduction for her. And it was this really amazing moment. You had thousands of people in the rotunda, and I got to introduce her to them, and she gave like a really cool speech about, you know, being there to support people and encouraging them to keep up the fight and all that. And I spoke at one of the big rallies too, one of the big, you know, 50, 75, 80,000 people rallies. And I think I did a pretty good job with that. It was the first Saturday of that. And that'll always like be in my mind as like an important and good moment. My wife apparently has a video of it somewhere, but I've never actually asked her to see it. I'm not that narcissist. So anyway, you know, dozens, hundreds of small little things like that that sort of emerged in this incredible moment that to even sit here and talk about it sort of befuddles me. Like, oh my God, did that really happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, that should, or that will, I guess, wrap it up for the day. So, Peter, thank you very much for your time. This concludes a follow-up interview with Peter Rickman. Okay, today is May 6th, 2015. This is the third interview with Peter Rickman. We're here in Milwaukee at the AFT, Local 212. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Peter, to test the sound quality, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure. Peter Rickman, R-I-C-K-M-A-N.
Thank you. We're going to start off, we finished off with your thoughts about the February March protests of 2011. The one question I don't think I asked about that is what I'd like to start with, and that's how do you believe the media presented or represented the protests?
Oh, man. I'm sure I'd give you a different answer today as compared to 2 years ago, as compared to 3.5 years ago, as compared to, like, you know, right around then. And the truth is, retrospectively, I don't have, like, a great view of it other than saying this. I think it was really fascinating to see the media try to talk about, you know, what amounted to a large-scale labor, militant labor action and upsurge, rebellion, whatever, in America for the first time in certainly my life. I think they got some things right. I think they got some things wrong. I think their general frame of reference, though, was so searching and wanting that it would have been hard for them, because this isn't, you know, what happened then isn't like a regular thing that they have a faculty for and a language to describe and you know, tropes to use to talk about it. So they put it in what they know how to do, and that it didn't necessarily fit. But I think on balance, most of the mainstream media that talked about it did their best to accurately portray, you know, what was happening. I think, you know, to my recollection, there was some sensationalizing of some of the crazier aspects, but that's always going to be the case in any sort of reporting that wasn't unique to the Wisconsin uprising or the Capitol occupation or anything like that. And the one other thing that I think would have been really helpful in the media, just for, you know, informed discourse in a democratic society, is for there to have been, you know, more of a substantive take on the issues at play and the context for it. You know, the role of unions, the rights of workers, the role of protest in when, you know, electoral, you know, legislative, parliamentary democracy sort of breaks down and fails
to align with the popular majority. So it's a lot of rambling ways of saying, you know, I don't even remember. I just have some recollections.
Well, thank you for those recollections. And so after February, March, still in the spring semester, what are your memories of sort of getting back into, you know, taking class, being in class?
I think I talked about it in one of our previous interviews, but I ended up dropping a class. you know, made up the work in other courses. And, you know, in some ways just tried to limp across the finish line of that semester and make sure that, you know, I did what I needed to walk out of there with decent enough grades for the future. You know, at that point in time, academic work took not just a backseat, but sort of moved way outside of my you know, conscious mind about what was important. And so I just remember, like, trying to be extremely businesslike with fulfilling the duties of my assistantship the remainder of that semester and sinking myself into the coursework enough and intensively enough that I could complete the courses, the academic requirements, and basically meet a threshold, but no more than that. It wasn't like I completely shifted gears. It was just I carved out enough space to handle the academic responsibilities. And, you know, not entirely within the remainder of that semester, but over the course of that semester and into the summer, you know, it definitely became clear to me that further pursuit of academia probably wasn't in the cards for me because a number of different reasons we can get into that too.
Yeah, and actually I think, I mean, one of the questions I have is the move from academia to the labor movement. So
yeah,
if you wouldn't mind just sort of elaborating on what you just said there.
Yeah, well, I had gone to grad school and law school, and I may have said this in a previous interview, a phrase I'll probably repeat a couple times here today because we've had enough time in between each of these. I'd gone to grad school and law school to appropriate some of the technical skills necessary for how I thought I could contribute to the union movement and the development of a real labor movement, a workers' movement, and left-wing politics. and I felt at that point in time that, you know, you go through the first year of law school, and it's extremely rigorous. It's focused a lot on technical skills, research, writing, analysis. You go through the first few years of grad school and, you know, it's sort of appropriating different theoretical approaches to, in that case, political policy and social movement issues. And you've gotten it. And that's not to diminish anyone who's spent their full time in law school or gone all the way through their doctoral degree, and people who make a career in academia or make a career practicing law. It's just that I felt like I had gotten to the point with the technical skills that I could appropriate in school myself to feel comfortable stepping outside of that and just dedicating myself completely, fully and wholly to what I knew I wanted to be doing over the long haul at that point in time. And that just, you know, every direction I turned in my gut, my head and my heart, I knew was the right thing to do, to focus in that moment, not just on like what I felt was the right thing for me, but where I felt like I had to be, because it was a moment of significant struggle and upsurge, and it was a moment of which advantage I thought had to be taken by anyone who, you know, sees themselves as aligned with the workers' movement or progressive forces or left politics. Like, there was a moment there where, you know, you could see a possibility to make major gains and breakthroughs, make progress and build for the future. And I felt like I had to be totally into that. It couldn't just be something that was an avocation on the side. It's something that I needed to immerse myself in completely. And to the extent that any of us view ourselves as being able to contribute significantly to social movement organizations and campaigning and all that, like, I felt like I owed it to the values and principles and ideals, whatever else that I, you know, to this day and before that hold dear, to contribute what I had. And so it was actually a relatively easy decision in many respects to say, I'm going to put academia on hold and dive into the movement work full time. Wasn't exactly sure how that was going to go. In my head, I told myself I would put academia on hold, but you know, I don't know if I actually ever meant that I was putting it on hold. I ended up taking like one more course each semester, just being in school. But I don't think I ever really had any intention of continuing in a real way. And it's funny because of late, an esteemed member of the faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, cross-appointed in three departments, has tried to convince me to go back to school. And I say to him, Joel, I don't think that's something I can do. I mean, I'll try to figure it out, but it's not part of who I am anymore.
I'll let you get a drink of water here while I ask a question I think I know the answer to, but I want to get it for sure. So then after the protest, as you're segueing, if you will, from academia to the labor movement, did you stay involved in the TAA?
Yeah. I mean, in that interregnum between the uprising and, you know, full-time work in the union movement, I was, you know, still very heavily involved in the TAA, you know, whether it was things around the recalls, and signature gathering and such, or you know, work being done around leading into, at that time, you know, another state budget, etc. Things on campus. Still absolutely very, very much involved in the TAA.
Okay, thank you. So let's move. You just mentioned the recalls, and we talked about them just sort of in general last time about when you started to hear about them. But I want to ask specifically now, in that year plus that we go from recalls of senators to eventually the recall of the governor, the attempted recall. Let's start with the overall question of your involvement in those recalls, and then we'll go from there specifically.
Well, from the very jump with the Senate recalls, you know, I certainly tried to play a role and position the organizational work with which I was involved around that. And, you know, we ran, caravan canvases to different senatorial districts out of the TAA office that, you know, I put together to take folks from Madison out to, you know, the 14th and the 18th Senate districts and some other places, so that, you know, we could generate these actual recalls. And, you know, I think it'd be far from unique in that, you know, I and that probably thousands of others did whatever we could to figure out a way to build, harness, and channel the grassroots energy, and to ensure that, you know, we continued the the politicization of people around you know, these transgressions against their interests, and you know, help people find a way for them to contribute to the work of signature gathering and then campaigning around the recalls. I don't think I'm at all unique in that. Like, I spent a significant amount of time, effort, and energy to do that. But going into the actual recall elections themselves of the senators, I think, you know, there's a wide variety of views, and not necessarily anymore a serious discussion or debate about this, but the way people took up those elections, those recall elections, special elections, I think is absolutely, you know, could be fascinating and could be a whole separate project. But in that regard, like, you know, I spent time going out and knocking on doors and talking to voters and potential voters about, you know, the elections and what was at stake. I did it all through the independent campaign. It went under the We Are Wisconsin banner, not aligned with the candidates themselves. And, you know, I can say some more about that if you like. But beyond that, also doing some things around, direct action and mobilization. I think elections have to be about the choices that are framed for people, not just about candidate personality contests. So that's one reason I was involved in some of the independent stuff. Again, happy to go into some more of that later. But we did this thing called Walkerville to shine a bright light on the budget
that Walker was moving, and connected to the attacks on worker rights, and just this austerity agenda of Walker and his you know, cronies in the legislature. So I view that as political action, just the same as, you know, going out and campaigning door to door for candidates and whatever else. And it, you know, there were different camps, so to speak, in terms of how people put their activism into that recall work. I, for one, think that, you know, is going to be a real political strategy for the left anytime now and in the future, and certainly looking historically, it's you know, a bubbling cauldron, a mix of things like direct action and protest and mobilization, along with, you know, parliamentary political action, and the overlap and intersection of those is where social movements become political movements and have the ability to, you know, change institutions, structures, and systems and such. So in my own small way, I was trying to contribute to that by doing some of the both and organizing other people into doing things like knocking on doors for the recall elections themselves, but also participating and organizing some of these large-scale disruptive actions, direct actions, mobilizations to frame the choice in those elections.
So so why choose to do this initial... So this initial work on the recalls through We Are Wisconsin, through the Independent?
So I think labor and progressive forces need a political organization of our own. And at the time, that's what, you know, many of us were trying to do, whether it's rank and file activists or institutional union leaders or you know, even seasoned political operatives of a progressive bent. You know, there were the most craven, who saw that, well, based upon campaign finance law, having an independent campaign and independent expenditure is a way to leverage far more money to be able to be spent. to, I think, the most idealistic, and I would certainly count myself amongst them, is that, you know, we need to build a political organization of our own. And if we rely upon the Democrats, conventional Democratic politicians, they would turn those recall elections, just like any election, into personality contests. They wouldn't talk about the fundamental issues at stake and at play, and it would be, you know, mushy mouth talking point politicking that doesn't inspire and certainly wouldn't carry the movement in the streets to the ballot box, much less the halls of government. And so an independent campaign allowed us to have a message of our own, allowed us to build an infrastructure and organization of our own that could continue along. You know, to be able to have the freedom to take this this political project on from the same wellspring of ideas and energy and action from which it came. We wanted this to be a political expression of, you know, the uprising. And that never has and shouldn't be conceived of something that would ever translate through candidates. You know, individual candidates are about getting themselves elected and continuing to be elected. And just as an aside, those of us who are, you know, part of that effort in many ways are now trying to build a long-term thing called the Working Families Party here to do this, and we view electing champions as an important part of that. But none of us, I don't think, would ever say that, you know, conventional politicians running in elections like those recalls were ever going to be, you know, political expressions of the movement as individuals. So we needed to have an institutional formation to do that. It didn't end up holding together over the long haul. I mean, We Are Wisconsin exists in name, but it's not the same sort of independent political organization rooted in alliance between labor and community organizations, and carrying social movements in the streets to the ballot box in the halls of government. There were tremendous lessons learned in that moment that we're, you know, trying to apply today in terms of building a long-term independent political organization. But that's a whole other story. To me, it was an ideological choice, an organizational choice, and a movement effectiveness choice, in addition to a values choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember whether it had to be... I'm going to fast forward now slightly to the signature gathering for the recall of the governor.
Yeah.
And I can't remember whether it was a year after election or a year after taking office that the... but I wonder if you could just talk again, starting sort of in general terms, about what you did to help gather signatures.
Well, November 17th of 2011, is when we kicked that off. I remember it well. It was over at 64th and Blue Mound. Maybe it was November 17th. Maybe I have my date wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was November 17th. It was supposed to be a year from the election. I think that's what the official ruling came down to be. We gathered probably 2,000 people there. Put together this event, on this play field outside of a school that was being renovated. And we had, a great rally. We had people who, could speak on behalf of different constituencies and organizations talking about why, there was a unified front to take on this recall of Walker, and that, the recall thing itself was not so much traditional parliamentary politics. In fact, just the opposite. It was a new approach, and that we weren't going to play by the rules of waiting 4 years to, have another shot at Walker or whatever. But this was instead an insurgent moment of political action, driven from below, from the grassroots, from ordinary people becoming active for the first time. And that's actually, in fact, what played out. That wasn't just rhetoric. But we had this great rally with, a few different speakers. And then we marched from there a couple blocks down to the streets, the street on which Scott Walker himself resides, or at least used to reside now. He claims his parents live in that house, but over on 68th Street. We had identified four households on that block that were strongly anti-Walker, and that they wanted to set up recall petition gathering tables in their driveways. So we did that. And so the whole thing was having a march to go over there, and then, everyone could sign the recall petition and then take petitions to go home with them. And, it was sort of like this massive picket line around 68th Street, just going around and around and around for hours and hours and hours. And it was great because it was middle-class, middle-aged people and their kids coming on out. And Walker is always playing the victim. He's like, oh, they're terrorizing my family. But, there were people, like, laughing and smiling and joking the whole time. It was his own neighbors who invited people into the neighborhood to come and be part of this. But that was, like, the kickoff to the whole recall thing. And I thought that was such an excellent way to do it. One, we were taking the fight right to Walker. And literally, he's brought the fight into the neighborhoods and the homes of ordinary people in the state, and we're going to reflect on that. And the movement has been built by ordinary, everyday people getting active and involved for the first time, social change from below. And that's exactly who's going to carry this kind of thing forward. And obviously that is, in fact, what turned out to happen in this period of time when the recall signature gathering ultimately concluded. Nearly a million of these was done entirely by activists. I mean, there was a paid staff infrastructure behind it, but that was like the paid staff went out and did this. This was ordinary, everyday people. So that was the kickoff. But leading into that, there had been a lot of discussions and debates amongst, activist groups and people from the union movement about the appropriate timing for this. And to this day, I think if you ask people what, the right timing for it was, they will have different opinions. And what was quickly recognized was that no matter what the appropriate decision is strategically on paper or in a vacuum, whether it was aligning it with the 2012 November elections when there'd be large-scale presidential election turnout potentially favoring a Democratic candidate or whatever else, the truth was the movement in the streets, the new activist people, were ready to go. And as soon as it was possible, someone was going to pull a recall petition out and start going. And then a bunch of people would get behind that. And so that's what everyone needed to do. So again, I thought that was actually a really fine thing in that it wasn't, the Democratic Party hierarchy or trade union bureaucrats, as some would say, defining this. This was defined by activists. And so no matter what the discussion and the debate was, it was always sort of what makes sense with where the activist base of people who are involved now and energized for most of them the first time in their lives gonna do. And then from there, I don't actually remember a ton about the recall signature gathering period of time, because it seemed like everyone
was doing it, but everyone had, you know, had already signed or whatever else, and it was just, you know, it was very it was very much a thing to do, you know, that people, it was a true social movement in that, you know, it was semi-autonomous, spurred on its own. People were just doing it because that's what people with any inkling of politics or who had suffered a transgression against their own interests had were doing. Do you want me to get into like going into the election itself? Yeah. So I remember sitting in what was then my office over on Highland Avenue here with some other union organizer types and politicos about what the left was going to do about this election. Those of us of the professional left, as some may say, you know, we weren't in the tank for, say, Kathleen Falk in the primary, although many labor people were. And I myself supported her because that's where, you know, the institutional union movement that I've been part of was at. We weren't necessarily in the tank for Tom Barrett in the election. But again, we thought the choice needed to be framed for people. And Kathleen Falk or Tom Barrett was not going to frame the appropriate choice. You know, again, candidate, typical Democratic candidate, politicking, personality contest kind of stuff. So we worked for months leading into what became the recall election period to, you know, establish a set of issues to be on the table, whether it was the rights of workers, but also the impact of austerity politics and the mix of, you know, part of our rap was we're not broke. We're just twisted. It's the money's in the hands of corporations and the rich and Wall Street. They've stripped the wealth out of our communities. It's not that we're too broke to be able to fund social programs like education and healthcare. And we, you know, we want to talk about K-12 and the universities and Medicaid and other healthcare programs. It's not that there's no money to pay for that. It's just it's been given to these other people. And it turns out that giving tax breaks to corporations of the rich doesn't in fact create jobs. So we had this sort of this generalized argument and campaign that we were moving, particularly in Milwaukee, but also in a couple other places, trying to build around the election so that, you know, the choice could be framed to impact the outcomes, but that also we could win with a mandate, because, you know, we knew that even if we beat Walker with the candidate that ultimately, you know, we wanted to see win, we'd have to translate it into something else. Just kindler and gentler austerity and neoliberalism wasn't going to cut it. So we were trying to impact the outcome but set up the next stage. So we had this generalized campaign around jobs, not cuts. And I think that was really cool because we got a lot of people who weren't necessarily into the fight over public sector worker rights or about unions, particularly low-income people of color in Milwaukee and in Racine and Kenosha, engaged in this struggle and linking that fight with the uprising itself and trade unionism, the labor movement, which, you know, I think the labor movement is at its best when it is sort of putting forward a left-wing critique of the world and connecting those struggles. I could go off and rant for a while about that. I'll spare you the ideological diatribes, blah blah blah. So, you know, we were building that campaign here through Wisconsin Jobs Now, and a larger coalition campaign, but Wisconsin Jobs Now was driving that, and along with SEIU. And then for the election itself, we built a massive field operation. By the day of the election, I think I had upwards of 300 paid staff in the field. The week before, it was something like 250. It wasn't just all last minute stuff. You know, we had a massive, massive field operation that was running here in Milwaukee. God, I was sleeping like 3, 4, maybe 5 hours a night. And we moved literally thousands upon thousands of votes of, again, low to moderate income people, particularly people of color in Milwaukee, to to beat Scott Walker. And just to put this into context, it was to beat Scott Walker and elect Tom Barrett, a mayor who has basically done nothing for these people. It was around this agitational view we had of striking back against the politics of austerity and neoliberalism and striking back against the man, so to speak, you know, translating people's righteous anger into a political action. And we sourced and generated through this incredible field infrastructure of literally hundreds of organizers out in the streets, scores and scores, dozens, hundreds, a thousand plus new activists who became what we call block captains. And the idea was that they'd organize the people in their neighborhood to go and vote, to vote against Walker, to vote for jobs, not cuts, and then to commit to keep up the fight on June 6th, no matter what. You know, I basically immersed myself in the work around the recall, from the signature gathering to the choice framing issue campaign work to running this massive get out the vote operation. And I'm laughing because I think the funniest thing over the course of it, and there were a lot of funny things, was getting garbage bags full of Egg McMuffins for the election day get out the vote program, where we were all there by like 5:30 in the morning, and just handing out from garbage bags these Egg McMuffins to people. Little did we know that in months we would be tackling McDonald's in the fight for 15.
So I guess it behooves me to ask then, so the feelings once the recall, once the votes came in, and then what, if anything, you did in the immediate aftermath, you know, either sort of personally for you to try to rebuild or for the larger movement?
So it was obviously a deeply disappointing and frustrating and crushing night. And those feelings lingered for some period of time. But for those of us of the left who believe in doing electoral work, it's far from the first disappointment in electoral loss, including losses to Walker. you know, and this is probably another conversation for another oral history project, but I think it was, for me, most devastating in that it would have such huge ramifications for the continued presence, even not just dynamism and vibrance, but the presence of a union movement in Wisconsin and nationally, an institutional union movement. There's always going to be a labor movement, but you know, the institutional forces of unionism took a huge blow that night because of the sanction for Walkerite anti-union politics, and the fact that that closed a door on the possibility of refashioning public employee unionism along the same lines as what it had been for you know, potentially a generation, in addition to what it's now obviously led to in terms of right to work law and passing here. So it was deeply disappointing and frustrating, but I think this is kind of humorous to me, because people of the left can always say, well, we told you so, you know, if only they'd just been more left-wing, if only they had, you know, talked more about worker rights, if only they had talked more about taxing the rich and, you know, sticking it to billionaires, and, you know, if only they had articulated an anti-austerity agenda of, you know, whatever. Then our candidate would have won. But I think we actually had a real case to be made there, because Tom Barrett ran such a, you know, I don't even want to call it centrist campaign, but a campaign, you know, failing to draw any distinction between him and Walker. It was based upon, look, I'm a nicer guy and you can trust me. It wasn't based upon anything programmatic, even though what had led to that point had been entirely programmatic. It wasn't just about Scott Walker's a dick, even though he is. It was all about the things that he was doing programmatically in government and what that meant to people's lives. And that's not the campaign that Tom Barrett ran. So we were, those of us who worked on the project that I was, you know, part of leading this work around jobs, not cuts, and then building this massive get out the vote infrastructure in the inner city, I think we're actually heartened still coming out of that because, one, we saw that our politics could work. There was a resonance to it. There was a valence to it. And it could help move low to moderate income people, particularly people of color, into political action. And that's something Milwaukee hasn't had, Wisconsin hasn't had in any sort of significant way. So we sort of threw ourselves into continuing to deepen that and strengthen that and build it alongside, you know, the left wings of the labor movement and the progressive forces who wanted to build, you know, a different kind of future. You know, I hate to be too electoralized in my descriptions and thinking, but they provide a periodization that I think is somewhat helpful for historical analysis. But, you know, we also knew that there was a November election coming up. And as much as people of the left like to say that, you know, oh, you know, there's not much difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, there actually is a significant amount of impact that it has on ordinary people's lives. And we knew that we needed to do something around beating Mitt Romney, reelecting Obama. So, you know, there was also sort of like, okay, not a whole lot of time to mourn. We have to organize. But again, we were developing, and I say we because there was a group of us, and I just count myself amongst that number and subsume basically everything that I was doing into, you know, what our collective leadership was all about here. We were really working to build a way to impact elections, build infrastructure in the field and leadership that could last, and you know, win elections with a mandate. And so we refined and were honing our model and wanted to test it as well in the 2012 election, while also continuing some of that work that we were doing around the, you know, this jobs not cuts, tax the corporations and the rich, invest in social programs, real jobs, raise wages, etc. So, you know, I tried to just bounce right back into the work of the struggle. Because it's easy to just get yourself into like a loop of depression. I also had the good fortune of having a roughly 8 months pregnant wife at the time. And we had our baby less than a month after the recall. Mm-hmm. So I had a little time to reset my mind in a different way. I do remember immediately after the election itself, a lot of questioning of sort of how we got there and what happened. But I think the best conversations I was part of, and I remember one phone call that I did, a conference call sitting in my house with a couple of union leaders from Wisconsin and one from Illinois who sort of aligned with us in a lot of ways and, you know, sort of a movement, left-wing kind of guy. You know, talking about, well, what do we do from here? And it was very much productive. It wasn't like lamenting and talking about woe is us. It was like, okay, so this is our situation. What are we going to do about this now? Do we find opportunity in this? What are the urgencies in front of us that we need to address? You know, what are the balance of forces and how do we shift that? How do we work with that? So coming out of that devastating recall loss, to me, the only thing you could ever do was fight. And I feel like, you know, since roughly 2008, I haven't taken any time off because whether there was big election things happening or ongoing union work or whatever, the time I had with my kid, my brand new kid, at that point in time is the only real time I have had off. And part of that is a coping mechanism for me, that coming out of such a devastating loss, not just for the election, but sort of what it signified, the only thing I could possibly do is figure out the new means and methods of struggle, you know, what the thing is to do for me, for the organizations of which I'm a part, and the movement as a whole. So I was immediately trying to channel myself and that around me into, you know, building the fight for a new day.
And at this point, I mean, you said earlier in terms of school you were taking a class every now and then, but at this point are you out of academia and into the labor movement?
Yeah, I had it would have been the fall of 2011 was the last semester in which I took any courses.
So then,
What about
And I still haven't checked my grade from that. It was a labor law class, so I'm pretty sure I got an A.
So then what did the aftermath of the 2012 election then, you know, you talk about being deeply disappointed, but wanting to carry on after the recall earlier that year. How do you feel after the 2012 election?
I think the thing for me about the 2012 presidential and senatorial election was twofold. One, it was incredible to have someone like Tammy Baldwin run and win. You know, this is an out lesbian from Madison who's a confirmed and self-avowed progressive running against a four-term Republican governor who was probably the most popular politician in Wisconsin history, certainly in contemporary, you know, political affairs. And she beat him. And she beat him not despite her progressive politics, but because of them and framing them in populist terms. And winning, I think she won, if not all of, nearly all of the media markets of the state, including those that are, you know, were allegedly not going to be very hospitable to someone like Tammy Baldwin. So to me, there was a really exciting thing coming out of that with the Wisconsin elections. And obviously winning the electoral votes for Barack Obama was good. I was really proud of the operation that we built and continued to lead on, linking, you know, community organizing work with the left of the labor movement and building neighborhood-based structures in Milwaukee on the north side, low-income people of color, to have something that they owned themselves for their own, you know, political struggle and liberation, at least in the electoral and legislative arenas. And we did great stuff in that election for it. And you can see, I should say this about what we did in the recall, we've continued to carry through even to this day. You know, have, you know, between 40 and 70 wards in the city of Milwaukee that we've worked pretty consistently. When we start, and I try to you know, present an accurate, not overly generous picture of the work, but, you know, leading into the Walker recall, we took at that time 70 of the lowest performing voter performance wards in the state of Wisconsin and turned them into 70 of the highest, and some of them were the highest. You know, you'd see voter turnout rates that were over 100%. And I know that sounds weird, but in the politicos mind, those of us who do politics, that's actually a real thing. Like, there's more people who, you know, turn out than what were previously considered possible there. Anyway, so we continued doing that in the 2012 election, and it was great because you could see this marked impact on vote outcomes amongst those who are considered the least likely to participate in the political process. That was very cool. And we, you know, again, continue to develop a leadership infrastructure coming out of that. And this was part of what SEIU was sponsoring as the Fight for a Fair Economy. And because of that work from the recall into the 2012 elections and the issue work along the way, that Jobs Not Cuts, anti-austerity stuff, and we were starting to take up more about raising wages, we made a decision ourselves, those of us who are collectively leading this and organizing it, to try to make this permanent, because we knew SEIU was going to, you know, discontinue this Fight for a Fair Economy program at some point, and we wanted to be able to build something for the long haul that was, you know, a grassroots community organization, a fighting force for low to moderate income people, particularly of people of color, that, you know, wanted to fight the 1% in the banks, wanted to, you know, struggle for economic justice, do politics, state and local level, and, you know, whatever else people wanted to organize around in the neighborhood. Sort of like building an acorn for Milwaukee in the 21st century. Milwaukee never had acorn, really. Wisconsin never really had much of acorn. And so that election itself was a major data point along the way of being able to say, yes, this can be important for the long term. This is necessary. And for me, that's super important because I'm just a big believer in organization building and structures and institutions, because that's what carries struggle forward and actually, I think, often births new struggle. But in any event, there was, to me, a lot of hope coming out of that. That there could be, you know, the development of this this permanent
fighting community organization. We could institutionalize that. Alongside of all this, you know, a bunch of us from the labor left and community organizations aligned with that and other political forces have been experimenting around with independent political organization. In fact, right out of this room here, we had done a number of primary election campaigns, Democratic primaries for state legislative seats. And that started to become something people were pretty excited about, an independent political organization. And so then coming out of 2012, it looked like, you know, we had the stuff and the building blocks to develop an independent political organization, which is now growing into our Wisconsin Working Families Party, to build this, you know, Acorn style grassroots community organization, which continues to exist, Wisconsin Jobs Now, and in fact is affiliated with the network of community organizations that come out of the ashes of Acorn itself, which I get a kick out of. So that work led directly to sort of where we are today, in terms of the professional left, the labor left in Wisconsin, in particular in Milwaukee. So I, you know, it felt like a really exciting time. And then, you know, I was riding the subway at, you know, 5 a.m. or whatever in Brooklyn on December 7th of 2012 thinking, yeah, this is crazy. I'm going to go talk to some fast food workers about going on strike today. And, you know, it went right from the election into, you know, birthing the fight for 15. I was there for that and had a team that was out in the field doing that. And so it was a very heady moment that I think, was an inflection point into where we are now. I think the political tide potentially could be turning in this country. I think we're at a really precarious moment for working class and poor people, because I think the 1% has figured out how to rig the rules of the system economically and politically, but there is enough of an upsurge and a fight back that, you know, the Wisconsin uprising started to create and occupy Wall Street, which we never got into, but it was also a big thing that I was part of here in Milwaukee, set the tone for a lot of some of this other stuff. You know, that started to create this arc that then aligned with community and labor organizing work and political expression. And I think there is this a general trend towards greater activity and aligned activity amongst forces of the left, constituencies and, you know, institutions that identify as such, the oppressed, so to speak, and then other institutions, that, you know, there's a real foment afoot, that could potentially, I think, dramatically change things. Now, I'm not one of those who's like, the revolution is just around the corner. I just don't believe that kind of shit. I'm just saying, you know, I think there's an alignment of some factors now that, in my honest and true opinion, not just because I was a somewhat significant part of this, started to shake free in that moment in 2011, and then sort of where it went and what we did here in Wisconsin, and obviously what lots and lots of other people in you know, elsewhere took and ran with in their own ways too.
Peter, I think you sort of hit on these last couple of questions I want to ask, but I want to ask them directly to see if there's anything else you want to talk about. So it's the sort of the final thought or thoughts on the February, March 2011, and let's start. I'd like to start actually statewide. And again, you've sort of talked about this, but what do you think the impact or impacts of what happened on the Capitol in February, March of 2011 have been seen since? Or,
well, I think the impacts statewide were actually a little greater than what they are now, even though I just got done ranting about, like, this is a moment of potential large-scale political change. That's at the, you know, the sort of 30,000-foot level. And that instant, that moment of the Wisconsin uprising and the Capitol occupation, I think really drew some lines in the sand that that reshaped the way people saw the impact of politics in their lives, the role of unions, the role of government, and you know, whose side politicians are on and what interests and class forces they align with. But it was a line in the sand, and that was something that people polarized around then. I think generally others saw that line and they said, well, we're going to run with this on our beach too. But it was a line in the sand. And, you know, sometimes the water laps over that and erodes that line. So I think in Wisconsin, some of that has shifted, although there's been more and more and more sticks being dragged across that beach, redrawing some of those lines. But it hasn't, you know, gotten, I'm just, this is a horse of a metaphor that I'm beating to a gluey pulp. There are other sticks that are being drawn through that sand to create further lines that I think, but for that massive upsurge then, would have just sort of been seen as politics as usual. And now I think politics is cast in a different light for people around the state. There is, and I actually celebrate this because I think politics should be a contested battle for the values that underpin the distribution of wealth and power and resources in a democratic society. I think there's more of a polarization around class and the role of government than what there was prior to that. And that has been reinforced by other things along the way. It's by no means to the extent that I would like it to be and think it can get to, because I think if there were politics in America turn on class, I think we would actually see a more just, equitable, and democratic society on every front, not just on the distribution of wealth. So that's a very, very general thing. But I think also that is overlaid against the general trends of precarity and anxiety about the economy and social structures and et cetera, that, you know, there's always the water lapping over those lines and that line has to be redrawn in the sand. I think the biggest stick possible was drawn through there in 2011 and made quite an indent. You know, if you're on the beach and you drag a stick through the sand and the water laps over it, if you've gone deep enough, you can still see some of it, and you have to keep digging and digging and digging if you want to really draw those lines. So there's some of that residual, but those waves are pretty powerful, and that water is significant in eroding some of that. So anyway, that's the general. Sorry, what was the question again?
So general, and now the impact on you specifically.
I think that the upsurge, like, you know, prior to the upsurge of 2011, I certainly saw myself as having generally leftist politics, totally committed to the union movement, and knowing that I wanted to make a life for myself in that. And people are made in struggle. I think people's politics and leadership is made in struggle. And for me, the upsurge of 2011 and this long tail, which, as I've described, I think is still sort of wagging right now, has, in terms of my own politics, helped deepen my own radicalization. But some of that is just as I grow older and see more of the world, I become more radical. It's probably the opposite of where a lot of people are. And having a kid has made me more radical too. But that moment of that open, naked class conflict certainly had a large scale and deep radicalizing impact upon me. In terms of, you know, how I do the work that I do in you know, this labor movement, you know, I just think it's totally a truism that as people become more experienced and they go through moments of pitched battle and the time in between and have to be thoughtful about, you know, what they learn in those experiences, they become different in how they do things. So I don't think it's any sort of dramatic overstatement to be like, I'm a totally different person in terms of how I do the work that I do in the movement since then. I think if someone weren't, they might have a problem. Also, you know, I'm a pretty young person still, so that was obviously going to have a big impact. that moment of upsurge combined with sort of where we are, but where I think the union movement can be and the left can be, has certainly redoubled my commitment to being part of this. And, you know, I think it was not entirely prescient, but just sort of logical about this, and it has certainly played out. I knew that I wanted to dedicate my life to this sort of thing. that accelerated it and clarified that for me. And it has only picked up momentum and gotten clearer for me, you know, now riding that long tail of the upsurge. You know, my plans for what my own life in the labor movement was going to be probably have changed some, but I think I'm not lamenting that. You know, I think I probably would have been much more likely to spend time building a public sector union movement career, although maybe not, because I was always sort of oriented towards low-wage private sector workers and building the struggle there. And now that's what I'm definitely into, and that's what I do. And, you know, this sort of helped create some of those opportunities moments to be seized upon and used. But I guess the most important impact for me in my life has just sort of been that as a moment shaping my own leadership in because, like I said, as people go through struggle, they're changed. And that was such an intensive moment that the degree of change and accelerated development was so great. And the long tail of that has continued in many respects, not quite as intense in the singular moment, mm-hmm. but has maintained a burning intensity throughout. Not sort of like, well, it's intense, and then it drops off, intense, and drops off. But it was super intense in that moment, but then it has just tailed off a bit.
Mm-hmm. So I want to give you space here at the end to, if there's anything you feel it's important within the context of these three interviews to get on the record or anything, perhaps, you know, they've been far enough apart that I don't expect you to remember exactly what we talked about, but if there are things on your mind, either specifically about February, March 2011, or what has happened in the 4+ years since that you want to make sure you talk about before we wrap up.
We'll save that for part two.
Okay.
I don't know if there's anything I could say right now that would add to or contribute significantly. I think, you know, whatever is in the oral history record, beyond my own remarks, the sum total of all those together might be far more interesting than anything else I would add here. But also, you know, I'm personally less of like a write a thing out or make a speech and that covers everything. I often do my best in response to other things. So mm-hmm. let me just say that I reserve the right to change my mind and say some other things based upon what else might be in this oral history record or what else is out there. Or you can just read my book. I'm just kidding. I'm not writing a book. Mm-hmm. I don't intend to write a book. Mm-hmm. But I say this, you know, entirely seriously. I think, you know, the dynamic exchange of views and thoughts on something like this is going to be far more interesting than just, you know, sort of a one unidirectional communique from me, and certainly some sort of, as compared to some kind of grand sum up or adding in things, oh yeah, and then this other thing, and oh yeah, don't let me forget this and that. So all that said, I think that's the longest way of saying, no, I don't have anything else to say. But you may have noticed I'm kind of good at that sort of thing.
Well, Peter, I too reserve the right at some point in the future to reconnect with you, but I think this will wrap it up for the oral history. So this concludes the oral history with Peter Rickman. Peter, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for your work on this project.